important, they're mentally important, they're socially important, they're culturally important.
I want to find out just what fibre can do for us.
You can hear it bubbling. That is the sound of deliciousness.
The Fibre Factor with me, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall. Next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 22nd of January. Good to be with you and have your company. This is Today with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett.
The headlines today: President Trump has said a potential deal over Greenland, which saw him lift his threat of tariffs on European allies, would give the US everything it needs. What does he mean by that? And what could the parameters of such a deal look like? We'll bring you analysis throughout the programme from the US and Europe, and we'll speak to the Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, at 8:10. Also today, several people, including children, are missing after a landslide engulfed a campsite in New Zealand.
We'll bring you what we have on that story as we get it. But also, coming up in today's programme, we've heard from the adults. Now it's time for the kids. What do they make of a possible ban on social media for under 16s?
I think there will still be people that will find a way around and will use social media still. But then some people will just accept the fact that they cannot do it and not bother.
I'm going to follow in the footsteps of Australia, some of our younger members, or hopefully younger listeners to come, on their views there. Hear from them in full at 7:30. And
the South Bank exhibition, Britain's proof to a doubting world that she still leads in science and discovery, draws to its close.
75 years after the Festival of Britain showcased art and culture across the country, a new travelling library celebrating the nation's poetry is about to go on its journey. More just before 9 o'clock. But first, the BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
President Trump has said that a possible deal covering the future of Greenland would achieve everything he wants and last forever, after rowing back on threats to seize the island by force or levy further tariffs on European allies who oppose his desire to own it. Mr. Trump announced he'd agreed what he called the framework of a future deal after talks at the World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos, but gave few details. Our North America editor Sarah Smith is following developments.
Donald Trump began his visit to Davos by insisting that the US needed to acquire Greenland for reasons of national security, saying, "You need the ownership to defend it." Then a matter of hours later, he used a social media post to announce that he and the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte had agreed the framework of a deal over Greenland. If consummated, he wrote, it would be a great solution for the US and all NATO nations. As a result, he said he would not impose tariffs on European allies. It is hard to see how Donald Trump can claim this as a victory when it does not appear that he will achieve his stated aim of taking full control of Greenland. One of the officials who attended the meeting has told the New York Times that Denmark could grant the US sovereignty over small pockets of land where military bases could be built. The idea is said to be based on the sovereign British bases in Cyprus.
European leaders are pressing ahead with an emergency summit in Brussels this evening. The reaction so far to President Trump's announcement has been cautious. Denmark's foreign minister said the day in Davos had ended on a better note than it began. President Trump has said President Putin has agreed to join his Board of Peace initiative. Mr. Putin has not confirmed this. Earlier, he said the Russian Foreign Ministry was still studying the invitation. Mr. Trump is planning a signing ceremony for the board in Davos later this morning. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
The Board of Peace was originally unveiled by the White House as part of a mechanism for the future governance of Gaza. It now appears to have morphed into something more like a rival to the United Nations. Its proposed charter, which makes no reference to Gaza, says the board will be an international organization that promotes stability and secures peace in areas of conflict. Countries wanting to join as permanent members will be asked to cough up $1 billion in cash. Donald Trump will serve as inaugural chairman and designate his own successor.
Several people, including children, are missing after a landslide at a campsite on the North Island of New Zealand. It happened at the popular tourist destination of Mount Maunganui after days of torrential rain. Our correspondent Katie Watson is following the story from Sydney.
One survivor said it was like being in a movie, a tourist town with a volcano and a huge landslide barreling towards some hot baths by a campsite, wiping out tents, caravans and a toilet block. It's peak summer in New Zealand, the last week of school holidays for many kids, and the campsite was busy. Authorities earlier said it was still a rescue situation, and another two people are missing after a landslide damaged a house in Welcome Bay, about half an hour's drive from the campsite. Much of the east coast of the North Island has been hit by bad weather in recent days. Some parts of the region saw as much rain in 12 hours as they would normally in a month, with New Zealand's Minister of Emergency Management, Mark Mitchell, comparing the damage to a war zone.
Families of patients who suffered or died after they caught infections in Scotland's largest hospital have said they were lied to, demeaned and smeared. An inquiry into patient safety at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital campus in Glasgow is hearing closing submissions this week. It was set up after the deaths of several children and adults. Our Scotland editor James Cook reports from Glasgow.
For years, NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde denied that water and ventilation failings were responsible for infections and deaths on the Glasgow Hospital campus, which opened in 2015. But in closing submissions to the Scottish Hospitals Inquiry, the Health Board issued a dramatic apology, admitting it was likely that some infections were caused by problems with the water system. In a statement issued by their lawyers this morning, the majority of the affected families accused the board of deceit and conniving cowardice. They demanded accountability for what they called despicable incompetence and claimed the hospital was still not safe. The NHS insists it is.
The House of Lords has voted in favour of banning under-16s from social media, passing a proposal brought forward by a Conservative peer. The government has indicated it will try to overturn the amendment in the Commons while it carries out its own consultation on a potential ban. There's been an increase in drug drive reoffending in England and Wales. Data obtained by the road safety charity I Am Road Smart shows a 36% rise between 2022 and 2024. Nearly half of drug driving offences are committed by a repeat offender. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
The data from the Ministry of Justice showed instances of reoffending by drug drivers increased to more than 3,000 in 2024, up from just over 2,500 in 2023 and 2,300 the year before. Police can conduct roadside tests on suspects for cannabis or cocaine. If they fail that or an impairment test, a blood test is taken at a police station. However, campaigners point out there are delays of up to 6 months to process them, during which time people can continue to drive. The government's recently launched road safety strategy proposed suspending the driving licences of those suspected of drug driving while waiting for test results.
Teaching unions are calling for more guidance to help parents make sure their children are ready to start school. A survey of just over 1,000 primary school staff by the early years charity Kindred Squared suggests more than a quarter of those who joined reception classes across England and Wales last year weren't toilet trained. It also found around 30% of children didn't know how to use books correctly, instead, for example, trying to tap them like a phone or tablet.
There you go. Caroline, thank you for that. At 7 minutes past six, let's get the latest on what's happening with the weather. Simon King is here for us. Morning, Simon.
Hi, morning, Emma. It's really not very nice out there this morning. There's a lot of clouds, some outbreaks of rain, some drizzle across many areas today, and the rain is going to be turning quite heavy in some parts as well. So across Wales and southwest England, it's really towards southeast Wales through parts of Somerset and Devon, where heavy and persistent rain here could lead to some flooding and some travel disruption through the course of today. Elsewhere across Wales and southwest England, the rain just likely to be on and off throughout the day, and temperatures of 7 to 10 Celsius. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, again, a pretty damp start with patchy rain and drizzle. The rain could turn a little bit heavier for a time, but generally not a lot of change as the day goes on, with highs of 7 to 9 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, so a pretty wet start with a lot of rain this morning. The bulk of that rain should tend to clear away to the northeast, so it will turn a bit drier later on today, highs of 7 to 9 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland today, well, it's a mostly dry start to Thursday. A bit of patch of rain and drizzle in eastern areas, but rain becomes heavier, more widespread and persistent from later this morning. The risk of some flooding with highs of 8 to 10 Celsius. And it's across Scotland where it is a particularly wet start to the day, especially in eastern Scotland, where we've got an amber warning from the Met Office in Grampian, Angus and Perth and Kinross. Because there's some flooding here with some significant rainfall totals, particularly over higher ground. But yet the rain continuing across much of Scotland, really, into this afternoon. A little bit drier towards northern areas with temperatures about 4 to 8 Celsius.
Simon, thank you so much. It is 9 minutes past six. Let's have a first look at this morning's paper, shall we? The majority of the front pages focus on Donald Trump's announcement of a framework deal for Greenland, including The Guardian, which says the US president abruptly stepped back from threats to impose tariffs on European allies as leverage after weeks of rhetoric that risked the deepest rupture in transatlantic relations in decades. The Times reports a sense of palpable relief in European capitals at the development, while the Daily Express suggests it proves Western nations should not panic every time Mr. Trump tries a new gambit.
The lack of details about the framework of that deal, which we're going to try and get to grips with throughout the programme, prompts several papers to speculate what could be involved. Sources have told the Daily Telegraph it stopped short of the sale of Greenland, but would instead allow the US to have sovereign control of its military bases on the island. According to the Daily Mail, Mr. Trump is mulling making the 57,000 residents of the territory an offer of $1 million each if they vote to join the US. NATO officials have told the I newspaper they fear the president could demand Greenland as the price of support for Ukraine.
The Daily Mirror is highly critical of Mr. Trump's appearance at the World Economic Forum in Davos, saying he delivered an unhinged and rambling speech to an audience of aghast world leaders. The Daily Star notes that the president repeatedly confused Greenland with Iceland, while the Daily Telegraph argues it was not so much a speech as a comedy special with bitchy anecdotes and savage impersonations. The paper describes Mr. Trump's parody of his French counterpart as evolving an accent that many European states would prosecute as a hate crime.
The main news for The Sun is the decision by Dame Prue Leith to leave the Great British Bake Off after almost a decade as a judge on the show. It claims she will be replaced by Nigella Lawson, with the TV cook said to be ready to sign on the dotted line ahead of the start of filming for the new series in April. The paper's headline plays on a well-known type of pastry, saying Nigella's a shoe-in.
That's quite good. It's 11 minutes past six.
It is, and happily for me, it worked when you actually said it aloud. If you have to imagine the spelling of it. Right, at 11 minutes past six, let's go to what we do or don't know. And it's a lot we don't, but we're going to try and see what we can read between the lines on this potential deal around Greenland. President Trump, because of it, has dropped his threat to impose tariffs on eight allies, including the UK, next month, after holding talks in Davos with the General Secretary of NATO over his Greenland ambitions. We are short on some of the details, but we can get perhaps some of the responses of EU leaders. Nick Beek is the BBC's Europe correspondent. Nick, what could be, what has been already the response of leaders in Europe, many of whom felt they stood up and they had resistance to what some were describing as Donald Trump's colonial ambitions?
Yeah, morning, Emma. I think Europe's still pretty stunned, actually, after what's been a tumultuous week. It was the foreign minister of Denmark who, with a very large dollop of Scandinavian understatement, said that yesterday had ended on a better note than it had begun, that it had begun. And I think, you know, there was this huge relief at the double Trump bombshell. First of all, taking the threat of military action off the table in his quest to get Greenland. And then secondly, the tariff U-turn. But I think, you know, the key thing is Europe will want to know more about the details, as you say, in this framework of a deal. What may have been promised to the US on Greenland or Denmark's behalf? And I think it's really hard, isn't it, to comprehend how such a quick fix has fulfilled President Trump's demand that was unwavering, he said, to own Greenland outright. But it does look like the NATO boss, Mark Rutte, has played his part, sort of fulfilled this role of being Trump whisperer, because he's taken the heat out of the row. And you remember last year, Emma, he was, you know, widely lampooned because he referred to Donald Trump as daddy.
Yes.
In praise of his ability to strong arm the NATO family into boosting their defense spending. But I think there is a sort of a sense now that the Secretary General has sort of helped to initiate one way or another the sort of the mother of all climb downs, because this really was a crisis that was threatening to blow apart the whole transatlantic alliance.
Well, that is a good scene setter for how we're going to try and explore what's happened or what hasn't happened and what has yet to be said. Nick Beek, our Europe correspondent, thank you.
13 minutes past six, just looking online at some extraordinary pictures coming out of New Zealand. Several people are missing after a dreadful landslide at a campground in the New Zealand tourist hotspot of Mount Maunganui. Let's speak to Katie Watson, our correspondent, who's on the story. Katie, morning from London. Just tell us what we know about what happened and what the latest is in terms of the human toll.
Yeah, so it was about 9:30 local time that there was a landslide that hit the Mount Maunganui Beach Holiday Park. Now, this is about 3 hours south of Auckland on the North Island. It's a very well-known volcano. People enjoy walking around. There's the Bay of Plenty. So it's a popular campsite. It's peak summer holidays in New Zealand. It's the last week of the summer holidays for many, many kids. But yeah, 9:30, a landslide hit, taking out tents, caravans, and also a shower and toilet block. So there are several people who are still unaccounted for, including, according to authorities, at least one young girl who is still missing. But rescuers say they are going to work through the night to try and rescue people. It's still a rescue operation, they said in an update. Earlier, there was an eyewitness who spoke to a local paper saying that they had heard people shouting for help initially, but now there is silence. It's a difficult situation because the rescuers say they still need to make sure that the land is okay to rescue people as well. There's been absolutely devastating weather in the last few days in some parts of the region. In 12 hours, they received as much rainfall as they would normally in a month, and one minister called it, compared it to a war zone.
Indeed. Katie Austin, good to talk to you. Thank you.
At a 6:15, the Chancellor appears to have closed the door on a business rates relief package that would extend beyond the promised help for pubs, leading to disappointment across the broader hospitality sector. Will Bain has more on that and the rest of the business news. Hello, Will.
Morning, Emma. Morning, Amol. Yes, this was the Chancellor speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos yesterday. He said the situation pubs face is different from other parts of hospitality sector, but we will be setting out the detail in the next few days. A Treasury official went on to tell our business editor, Simon Jack, that whilst they were not ruling anything further in or out in terms of support, the package to be announced in the coming days is just for pubs. Well, Martin Ingham is with us, the chief executive of the 10,000-seat entertainment venue, the Motorpoint Arena in Nottingham. Martin, morning. If that turns out to be the case, then disappointment, I'm guessing.
A huge disappointment, given that we feel that live music venues can make exactly the same case as made by pubs. Arenas, the 23 arenas in the National Arenas Association in the UK contribute £1.85 billion into the economy. £1.2 billion of that is in the venues themselves, but £648 million of that is on surrounding hospitality venues. So we're a massive driver of business to the high street, and it's completely unfair to exclude us from the same reliefs that any pubs will get.
Can you talk us through the changes that you will see from April in your own business rates then?
So we're seeing a ridiculous increase of 238% on our rateable value, which will put hundreds of thousands of pounds of cost on our venue, and similarly across the sector. We're talking about millions of pounds across the arenas in the UK, and that's just, you know, on top of all of the other increases that we've had. It compounds the other cost increases that we've had from government policy in relation to the national minimum wage, employers' national insurance, as well as the market forces from utility bills doubling in the last few years, insurance increases, supply chain increases. And of course, live venues were closed for 18 months during COVID, and we're still, most of us, recovering from that. We've still, in our venue, still got over £5 million of loans that were due to repay. And if government continues to just levy cost after cost, there's little prospect of us being able to recover that in the short to medium term.
What does that mean then? Hundreds of thousands of pounds of cost. And would that come in what? You're talking in the first year after these changes, right? What would that mean from a business perspective?
Well, from us, we've got to try and mitigate that. I mean, when you get increases in areas like employment costs, you can partly mitigate that by investing and reducing your staffing costs. Or if your energy costs go up, you can mitigate by investment in energy saving initiatives. But business rates are a blunt instrument, so there's no means to mitigate it other than going to pass charges on to the customer. So it means that ticket prices will go up because venues will have no choice other than to increase rents to the promoters and themselves, you know, charging venue facility fees, trying to recover it directly. So whether customers face that increase on the actual face value of a ticket or other fees and charges, that will add to inflationary pressures in the economy. Or, as venues, we've got to look at where our costs are, and our biggest cost is always people.
And it's the worry from your perspective, let's come to the jobs in a moment, but also that those promoters and their acts may just think, you know what, we can't make money if you're going to charge us that to rent out your venue, and people in Nottingham as a result are not going to see that show.
Absolutely. No, promoters are risk takers. They've got to assess the viability of any particular tour in any particular venue. And we certainly see in the lower capacity venues that there is definitely a viability problem now with a lot of touring. And if you continue to increase the cost pressures on the biggest venues, then that's going to see its way work up the chain. And, you know, fewer shows means, ironically, that there'll be an impact on those businesses, those hospitality businesses in and around arenas, including pubs. So it's a self-defeating policy to simply load extra costs on arenas when we add so much business to those very pubs that the government is talking about supporting.
And when you say reduce staffing costs, that's a euphemism, isn't it? It means letting people go.
I mean, we'll have no choice. The reality is that the single biggest cost in the hospitality business is people. And, you know, we're going to have to find ways of doing the same or more with fewer staffing resources,
so
I'm afraid.
So we heard from Simon that not ruling anything in or out in terms of further support, if you were to have your choice over what that would look like, is it extending those COVID reliefs? Is that what the industry would like?
Absolutely. I think we have to see an extension in the short term for those reliefs. But I think it then also requires a complete review of how business rates works in the cultural sector. And because a lot of us are sat in large, expensive buildings to run with where profits are nowhere near the level that you would expect in a normal commercial business. So I think the whole issue of business rates needs to be reviewed for cultural business, cultural venues.
Yeah, and that was certainly in the Labour Party manifesto and something the government has said they are still looking at a wider review of business rates. Martin, thanks so much for your time this morning. Martin Ingham, the Chief Executive of the Motorpoint Arena in Nottingham there. Well, Sophie Hewn is with us, Portfolio Manager and Strategist at BNP Paribas Asset Management, to look through the financial markets today. Morning, Sophie.
Hi, good morning.
And I'm guessing a bit of a calmer day expected on markets than the last couple. Was there immediate reaction to President Trump's speech in Davos yesterday and the news that those tariffs looked like they were going away?
Immediate reaction is, oh, he might have taco again, like chicken out. But I think overall, I think we're past this environment where the rule-based order is behind us. I think more specifically on Greenland, it's really showing that there's basically this rush to secure minerals as well as fuels. So all these commodities piling is going to be quite important. But overall, I would say that the market reaction in Europe is going to be quite positive because no tariff means that it's going to be back to business as usual.
Well, is it another nudge for finding new supply chains, new ways of doing business? Is it a reminder of the potential volatility of all of this?
Yeah, definitely. I think Europe is in quite a stuck situation where they were in the middle of China on one hand, where there's this fears about this overcapacity export and deflation. And on the other side, you have the pressure from the US, where European coordination could be better. But I think the fact that if we have a Europe that is much more solid and much more unified with much more trade flows, I think it's definitely going to be the path forward.
So if we zoom into the markets and companies specifically, interesting bit of news here in the UK yesterday. Next, the fashion retailer buying Russell and Bromley, who've been in trouble having fallen into administration.
Yeah, so I think it's symptomatic of the fact that the retail sector in UK has been struggling. So if you look at what Musk couple of companies, the biggest retailers in UK, have been saying they faced a tough Christmas. I think the acquisition of Next of Russell & Bromley is symptomatic of their strategy. So they've done that with Race and Jewels. I think it's part of this international expansion. So they got this rapid overseas growth, as well as much more revenues generated online. So I think it's going forward for Next, it's really good. So really a company to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Been one of the strongest stock market performers of the last few years, hasn't it, as well? Yeah. Sophie, thanks as always for your time. Sophie Hewn, Portfolio Manager and Strategist at BNP Paribas Asset Management there. Well, in the heat of all the geopolitics that we've been chatting about dominating Davos this week, it's been easy to overlook the fact the World Economic Forum is also supposed to be about business. And one of the big themes that was meant to be at this year's Davos was AI and its implementation, but also a focus on the race to develop quantum computing, potentially far more powerful than the world's top supercomputers. Nicola De Masi is with us, the chief executive and chairman of IonQ, a quantum computing company valued at more than $17 billion. And he joins us live from Davos. Nicola, morning.
Pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what you do at IonQ.
Well, we're actually the largest quantum platform company in history. We've been going for 30 years. We were the first player that was actually public on the NYSE back in 2020. And we are the leader in quantum computing, but also quantum networking, quantum security, and quantum sensing. And we're able to actually cater for solutions across this platform for our customers. So yeah, it's been a fantastic week for me, engaging with both national leaders, sovereigns, and of course, you know, the Fortune 500, all represented here.
And to you guys, AI, old news, basically.
Well, look, I think our QPUs, as we call it, quantum processing units, are absolutely the next leg of the computing revolution, which is 80 years in the making. You know, we've been through the CPU genre era. We've been through the GPU era. Jensen's obviously, on top of the world right now. But I think there is a broad recognition that, you know, the coming years will be about quantum processing units, quantum security, quantum sensing.
Why? Because it's just more efficient, because it's just quicker.
Well, each one of these is a sort of different technology, right? So quantum networking and security is about being able to transmit information in an unhackable way, using the principles of quantum mechanics. Quantum computing is about solving problems that can never be solved, even using all the world's supercomputers together. Once again, using the power of quantum mechanics and quantum algorithms. And quantum sensing is using quantum mechanics to do things like GPS, which is a form of quantum sensing that everybody in the world is familiar with and uses. But we're advancing that also.
And what about the skepticism then? Because it's a similar skepticism too with AI, isn't it? That there's no returns on investment on this yet, and yet it's sucking up billions and billions of dollars.
Well, I mean, let's stand back for a second and say, like, look, I mean, for classical AI, I don't think anyone can say you're not getting a return if you've bought NVIDIA stock or Broadcom stock, right? I mean, they make huge amounts of revenue, obviously, from their Blackwell chips and so on. Our business is the commercial leader in all quantum technologies, and we're doubling revenue every year. We did almost the same revenue in Q3 25 that we did in all of 24. We're the biggest market capitalization, best capitalized balance sheet, most PhDs, most employees, sort of the 800-pound gorilla of quantum, no matter how you measure it. And I think there's broad recognition in the tech space that if you are the market leader, the chance that you're going to have outsized returns due to the fact that you're building an ecosystem that customers are bought into and stay with is exponentially higher than when you're not the market leader, right? Well, and so that's what's being discounted, I think, as we continue to grow successfully.
Well, thanks so much for speaking to us this morning. Nicola De Masi, the Chief Executive and Chairman at IonQ.
And Will, thank you very much indeed. 28 minutes past six, time to say good morning to Mike Williams, who's got the sport. Good morning, Mike.
A very good morning, Amal, and it was a good night all round for the three English clubs in Champions League action last night.
And Cody Gakpo seals it, no doubt about it now. In stoppage time, Liverpool get their third.
What an excellent goal for Harvey Barnes. Newcastle United surely now guaranteed at least the playoff spot. They lead PSV Eindhoven 3-0.
Kicked off the head of Landry Dematter and in. Moises Caicedo, and Chelsea finally have the lead.
Yes, wins for Liverpool, Newcastle and Chelsea last night. Let's start in the south of France, where Mo Salah made his first start for Liverpool since November as they eased past Marseille 3-0. No goal or assist for Salah on his return, but he did play the full 90 minutes and, despite their recent very public falling out, manager Arne Slot insists he's glad to have the Egyptian back in the side.
He knows his teammates and he knows how we want to play. And it says a lot about how big of a professional he is, that being away with us for a month in a different team, that he was so fit to play today 90. I think he was close to a goal.
Elsewhere, Newcastle are guaranteed at least a Champions League playoff spot. Eddie Howe's team won 3-0 at home to PSV.
I thought it was good today, but it was good tactically, it was good athletically, relationships looked quite good, but I just think having the two centre-forwards fit and available is as transformative for us, because we don't have to overcook one player.
Newcastle could still automatically qualify for the knockout stage if they beat PSG in their final league game next week. Meanwhile, it took Chelsea 77 minutes to beat the Cypriot debutants Paphos at Stamford Bridge. A late header from Moises Caicedo saw them win 1-0 in what was new manager Liam Rossini's first European match in charge.
You have to keep knocking on the door, but you also have to keep the back door shut. There are things I was pleased with, there are things that we need to improve on. But overall, the body language of the group, they kept going. I was delighted for Moy to get the goal and get the result we deserved.
Elsewhere in the Champions League, Harry Kane scored twice and missed a penalty as 10-man Bayern Munich secured their place in the last 16 with victory over Union Saint-Gilloise. Whilst in the Women's League Cup, Manchester United are through to the final for the first time. They beat Arsenal by 1-0. They'll play Chelsea in March after they beat Manchester City. Next, let's head live to Melbourne. Day 5 of the Australian Open tennis is well underway. No Brits in action today. Cameron Norrie, the only Brit remaining in the singles, remember, he played tomorrow. Instead, Abigail Johnson is watching Iga Świątek in the women's draw.
Yeah, and the world number 2 was up an early break on Czechia's Maria Buzkova on the third show court, John Cain Arena, but Buzkova has just broken back. 40-year-old Stan Wawrinka also on court, hoping to keep his final Australian Open campaign alive. The 2014 champion trails Frenchman Arthur Gaya by a set. No shocks thus far on a sunny but fairly blustery Thursday at Melbourne Park. The likes of Amanda Anisimova, Ben Shelton, Jessica Pegula and defending champion Madison Keys all progressed without dropping a set, and 10-time champion Novak Djokovic did the same, keeping the day session clipped on Rod Laver Arena with a 6-3, 6-2, 6-2 defeat of Italy's Francesco Maestrelli.
Thank you, Abigail. The Five Live Tennis team on air with Five Live Tennis Breakfast on BBC Sounds from 7 a.m. Great to hear Stan Wawrinka still on court, rolling back the years at the age of 40. One of the great names of tennis over the last couple of decades.
Rolling back the years at that age, I'll take it. Thanks very much, Mike. On Mondays, James Naughtie's series continues.
What does it mean to be an American? The ever-present question that has troubled that country for 2.5 centuries.
It's about all the different immigrants who came to this country to make this country better.
This is James Naughtie, and I've been traveling across the United States discussing the ideas that shaped America from the beginning and still shape it today.
Every single person has power, but we've got to use our power in a collective, non-violent way.
From the Civil War to civil rights, from immigration battles to identity politics.
People here feel that they're invisible, frankly, and I think that's one of the problems.
An American Journey continues on Monday morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Really looking forward to that from Jim in the year that America turns 250. Now, the time is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan. Here's a summary of the news from Caroline Nichols.
European leaders are taking stock of President Trump's announcement of a framework of a future deal on Greenland. Yesterday, he rode back on threats to seize the island by force or to levy further tariffs on allies who opposed the plans. Mr. Trump offered little detail, but he said it would be great for the United States and the NATO military alliance. The NATO Secretary-General, Mark Rutte, said there was still a lot of work to be done. President Trump has said that President Putin has agreed to join his Board of Peace, a body which aims to resolve international conflicts. But the Russian leader has not yet confirmed his acceptance of the invitation. Mr. Trump is planning a signing ceremony for the organisation's charter in Davos later. Rescuers in New Zealand are searching for several people, including children, who are missing after a landslide at a campsite on the North Island. Tons of mud buried a shower block and hit multiple caravans at the grounds, which lie at the foot of Mount Maunganui. Families of patients who suffered or died after they caught infections in Scotland's largest hospital have said they were lied to, demeaned and smeared. An inquiry into patient safety at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital campus in Glasgow is hearing closing submissions this week. NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde has since admitted that the complex, which was opened in 2015, faced design flaws and infections were probably linked to issues with the hospital's water system. Teaching unions are calling for more support to help families to prepare their children for primary school. The early years charity Kindred Squared said a survey had suggested more than a third of children started school in England and Wales last year, not having the basic life skills to engage with the curriculum. There's been a sharp increase in instances of reoffending by drug drivers in England and Wales. Data obtained by the road safety charity I Am Road Smart shows a 36% rise between 2022 and 2024. Nearly half of drug driving offences are committed by a repeat offender.
Carolyn, thank you. It's 26 minutes to seven. As you've been hearing, President Trump has dropped his threat to impose tariffs on eight allies, including the UK, next month after those talks in Davos with the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte. Mr. Trump said a very productive meeting had led to the framework of a potential deal covering Greenland and the Arctic region. Peter Bowes is our North America correspondent. He has the latest, brings us up to date on developments overnight.
Many questions remain about the future of Greenland. The US has pulled back from the brink of what was an escalating crisis with European countries. The planned tariffs, punitive tariffs, including against the UK for opposing Donald Trump's once stated goal of owning Greenland, they've been called off by the president. He is now touting a framework of a possible deal with NATO. We're still short on details. Speaking to CNBC last night, the president appeared to confirm that it would involve mineral rights and the US's planned Golden Dome missile system, the system primarily designed to protect the US and Canada from long-range missiles. The New York Times is reporting that NATO officials separately discussed the possibility of the United States being given sovereignty over some land, pockets of land in Greenland, where it could establish military bases. But Mr. Trump's once implied threat to use force to assert American ownership is no longer on the cards. He said he wouldn't do that, although it was interesting that in an interview with Fox News, the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said that the question of Danish sovereignty over Greenland and the prospect of the US taking it over was not discussed during his meeting with the president. It didn't come up, he said, which seems remarkable given Donald Trump's previous position that it was the central issue.
And back at home, what's been the reaction, and specifically in Washington, to this idea of a framework of a deal and what we do know of it?
Yeah, well, I think across the country, and despite a considerable amount of news coverage, I think it's fair to say that the future of Greenland is not on the minds of many Americans. They have other concerns at the moment. But the most tangible reaction here came in the markets. US stocks, which on Tuesday suffered their worst day since last October, they rallied sharply yesterday, I think clearly sensing that this unsettling period of uncertainty over Greenland could be coming to a close. That aside, and I think this is being expressed across Washington, there is still much scratching of heads over what exactly prompted the president's apparent climb down when he was so adamant earlier this week that you need the ownership to defend it.
Peter Bowes, our North America correspondent. Thank you.
23 minutes to seven. What does that mean for domestic politics? Let's turn to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. Henry, it was a tricky week for Keir Starmer because he's made a great play out of, you know, his relationship with Donald Trump being one of his sort of successes. He's touted this deal. And yet this week he did sort of strike out against Trump. Where is that Starmer-Trump relationship and the UK-US relationship at the end of this turbulent week?
I think in a difficult place. I mean, there's relief and I think also a measure of pride in government. This morning, they are relieved that the tariffs are not going to be applied and proud of the diplomatic efforts that they say went into assisting this deal, whatever framework of a deal it becomes, on Greenland, which, you know, looks like a Trump climb down. But there is no getting away from the fact that an awful lot of eggs got broken on the way to making this omelette. I mean, it is hard to see, as you say, how the relationship between President Trump and Keir Starmer can revert to quite what it was over the past year, given the president's tirade on Tuesday morning, and then the prime minister's vow not to yield at PMQs yesterday. Notable, by the way, that that PMQs, where he toughened his rhetoric on President Trump, albeit while defending the importance of not getting into tit-for-tat threats, was probably his most successful PMQs for months. There are also, I think it's worth saying, specific questions now, I think, as a consequence of this week, about that deal over the Chagos Islands. I mean, Sakir was clear that he believed President Trump was only using the issue as a way to get to him over Greenland. And I think that's certainly bolstered by President Trump not really giving a coherent explanation for why he changed his mind. But we are still left with a situation where a deal about the security of a US military base is now objected to by the US government. That seems quite problematic. But above all, we are left with a lot of questions about the viability of the Western alliance and its institutions. Feels to me like those questions are being asked across political parties here in the UK like never before. And in that context, President Trump backing down on Greenland may just be temporary respite.
And in terms of the domestic agenda, Henry, there's this interesting vote in the Lords about social media and its a potential ban for under-16s. Where's the government got to on that?
Well, yesterday in the House of Lords, this vote took place. It was won by those pushing for the ban by 261 votes, principally Conservatives and Liberal Democrats, to 150 votes, which was the Labour Party. So that is a significant moment in public policy, which I think will herald down the track a more significant moment. This is going to come back to the House of Commons. We're expecting the House of Commons to take out this provision from the legislation because, as was announced earlier this week, the government is launching its own consultation on what to do next. But people I speak to seem overwhelmingly to think it is inevitable that before long the government position is going to be either a full ban on social media for under-16s or something quite close to it. The conversation on this is moving very fast.
And we're going to hear from some kids, from 12-year-olds I spoke to about social media and a potential ban at 7:30. Henry Zeppin, thank you so much.
It is 7:20. An emotional Prince Harry told a court yesterday that the Daily Mail newspaper group had made the life of his wife, Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, a misery. He was appearing in court in the latest of his battles to take on newspaper groups over alleged unlawful behaviour in their coverage of him and how they acquired personal information, all of which in this case Associated Newspaper Limited deny. Joining the Duke in this particular lawsuit are Liz Hurley, Sadie Frost, Sir Elton John and his husband David Furnish, Sir Simon Hughes, the former Liberal Democrat MP, and Baroness Doreen Lawrence, the campaigner whose son Stephen Lawrence was murdered in a racist attack. Tom Simons is our BBC correspondent. Tom, I said a small amount of what was coming from Prince Harry yesterday, but tell us a bit more and also of those emotions.
Yeah, it was quite a short stint in the witness box for Prince Harry this time, and he kept it broad brush. And he said that the court battle had been a horrible experience for his family, and he wanted an apology and some accountability for what he described as an endless pursuit by the Daily Mail titles, a campaign, an obsession with having every aspect of his life under surveillance. And he said they probably wanted to drive him to drink and drugs to sell more newspapers. So it was quite broad brush. I think one of the more interesting sections of it was where the barrister for the Mail titles was trying to explore where stories came from. And he said that in many cases the newspapers got scoops by cultivating people in the prince's social circle. And he said about one journalist that she made a career, this was Prince Harry, of turning up at these events, and everyone knew who she was, so nobody would be loose-lipped around her. So what he's saying there is, none of my friends would have given these journalists stories. They must have got them through using unlawful methods. And it was quite emotional, some of his evidence. At times his voice broke, he got quite tense and tetchy at times with some of the questions he was being asked, and the judge had to say to him, look, just answer the questions, give your evidence, you don't have to prove your case here. But he's done now, and we understand he's going to turn up at court again today to support the other alleged victims in this case.
As I say, the group denies it, but it is the third major court battle of Prince Harry against newspaper groups. In December 23, he won 15 claims against Mirror Group newspapers and later settled others, while the Sun publisher has apologised and agreed to pay substantial damages to the Duke in January 2025. How long is this due to last, this whole process, do we know?
Well, it's a 9-week trial and then presumably some months potentially for the judge to write up his findings and come to a conclusion. Of course, as you say, Associated Newspapers says that its journalist did good on-the-ground research, obtained information through standard sources, drawn previous coverage, and A&L has said that its journalists are lining up to give evidence in this case. So they will be hearing from, in court, a number of different journalists involved in the stories against the seven who are making these claims. So this is going to be quite a process and being hard fought, I think, on both sides. Yes. There were opportunities potentially to settle before this trial came, but they have not been taken.
Tom Symonds, our BBC correspondent, thank you.
It's 16 minutes to seven.
He may have been hundreds of miles away, but the US President, Donald Trump, who's certainly a big part of what we're discussing today and his policies, cast a long shadow over Prime Minister's questions yesterday in Parliament, Elisa McCarthy reports.
With pronouncements on taking over Greenland and condemnation of the UK's Chagos Islands deal, Donald Trump had already created plenty of political turbulence, and it was only Wednesday. As everyone waited for the US president to arrive at the World Economic Forum in the Swiss city of Davos, the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, wanted to know how Sir Keir Starmer's recent chats with Donald Trump had gone.
The Prime Minister and I agree. The future of Greenland should only be decided by the people of Greenland. Yeah. When the Prime Minister made this point to President Trump on Monday, did the President agree or disagree?
Donald Trump reckons if he doesn't take control of Greenland, Russia or China will. And he'd left European leaders aghast with a threat to slap whacking taxes on countries, including the UK, that don't support his plan. Keir Starmer said the future of Greenland was for it and Denmark to decide, and that threat of trade tariffs was completely wrong, and he beefed up his language to say so.
I will not yield, Britain will not yield, on our principles and values about the future of Greenland under threats of tariffs. And that is my clear position.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very glad to hear the Prime Minister say that. We all know that the people of Greenland do not want to be ruled by America. But does he agree that just as those in Greenland should decide their own future, so should the Chagossians? Yeah!
In another social media blast, Donald Trump described a deal for the UK to hand sovereignty of the Indian Ocean Chagos Islands to Mauritius as an act of great stupidity. Under the agreement, the UK would sign a multi-billion pound lease to keep hold of a US-UK military base on Diego Garcia for 99 years.
President Trump deployed words on Chagos yesterday that were different to his previous words of welcome and support when I met him in the White House. He deployed those words yesterday for the express purpose of putting pressure on me and Britain in relation to my values and principles on the future of Greenland. Mr. Speaker, he wants me to yield on my position, and I'm not going to do so.
But Kemi Badenoch said her party hadn't needed Donald Trump to tell them that the Chagos deal was stupid and a sign of weakness.
The Prime Minister is giving away territory we own and paying £35 billion for the privilege. Why doesn't he just scrap this terrible deal and put the money into our armed forces?
The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, accused Donald Trump of behaving like a crime boss, threatening to smash up the UK economy unless he got his hands on Greenland. He urged the Prime Minister,
take our advice this time and join Prime Minister Carney and President Macron in standing up far more strongly to President Trump.
Keir Starmer argued the UK had to work with the US, particularly when it came to Ukraine, but that didn't mean agreeing on everything.
But it is foolhardy to think that we should rip up our relationship with the US, abandon Ukraine and so many other things that are important to our defence, security and intelligence.
As the Prime Minister answered the next question, the noise from the Tory benches ramped up, prompting him to observe,
those that shout loudest end up over there.
He gestured to the Reform benches. Reform MPs threw up their hands as if defending themselves from Tory defectors. But with no sign of the noise abating, the Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, stepped in.
Order, 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 Prime Minister. Mr. Holden, I think you need to leave.
And with that, the Speaker sent the Conservative Richard Holden out of the chamber. Labour members enthusiastically waved him goodbye. And a few minutes later, the session came to a close, just as Donald Trump was warming up to set out his latest thoughts in a speech to global leaders in Davos.
Our parliamentary correspondent there reporting on yesterday in Parliament, Alicia McCarthy.
Child health in this country is so uneven and in some places so bad that the workforce of health visitors, those lovely people that often visit in the crazy, wonderful days after a newborn arrives and then return to check up on you, that workforce needs to be boosted. That's the recommendation of the Health and Social Care Committee of MPs. They point out that the number of health visitors has fallen by 43% since 2015. Rising levels of child obesity and vaccination coverage that varies hugely by postcode make this task urgent, according to those MPs. We're taking a great and particular interest in babies this year as part of our Today's Babies series. That's partly why we're looking into this today. And Dr. Helen Stewart, Officer for Health Improvement at the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, joins us now. Dr. Stewart, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. You gave evidence to the committee. What did you tell them about the scale of the challenge with that workforce of health visitors?
Yeah, thank you. So I gave evidence particularly regarding vaccinations in the early years. And we think at the Royal College that health visitors are such an important part of that. We know that vaccination rates have been falling for years, and despite the vaccine strategy a couple of years ago, unfortunately, that hasn't really seen a change. And you'll know that last year we had deaths from measles and pertussis in this country, which is just a tragedy for every family involved. So we think that health visitors are ideally placed to address some of the barriers that parents feel that they face to getting their child vaccinated. So one of their issues is that they just don't feel that they have a trusted healthcare professional to discuss concerns with. There's so much information out there about vaccinations that it can be really hard for parents to work out what to believe and what not to believe.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of that information is completely wrong, whereas health visitors will have accurate information, including about the success of vaccines. It's interesting, Dr. Stewart, you say the vaccination rates have fallen significantly. Why? Why are vaccinations A, falling, and B, so patchy by postcode?
So there's a whole range of reasons why that is the case. Obviously, misinformation plays a part, but we actually find when we spoke to parents that a lot of their concerns are around how to just access appointments. Vaccinating your child should be really easy, and a lot of situations it's not. You've got to get appointments at GPs. If you miss letters from schools, it can be really hard to find ways to catch up. And we just think health visitors being able to do that in people's homes would really improve their access to this service. And one of the reasons for geographical variation is the fact that there is a link with people living in more deprived circumstances. They have less access to primary care. It's harder for them to make appointments. It's harder for them to take time off work. So actually, health visitors can get into all these communities, address their concerns, and vaccinate while they're there.
And why is it that the number of health visitors has fallen since 2015 by 43%, almost half?
It's hard to know for sure. I know the Institute of Health Visitors have done a lot of work on this. Part of it is going to be around investment. Part of it is going to be around finding the right people to fill the jobs. It's a really complex picture.
Okay, what do you think, other than money, what could improve and raise that number? Is it conditions? Is it sort of is it pay for those workers? What do you need to do? Obviously the NHS is under huge strain, but there is this community sort of emphasis from Wes Streeting. What would it take to get that number back up, do you think?
I think it is. A large amount of it is about investment. Health visitors, what they report is they want to spend more time with families. They want to be able to build those bonds and answer those questions. So without more investment, giving more health visitors who are well trained in the public health aspects that they can deal with, then they don't have that capacity. So just having more of them will really help that.
Okay, Dr. Helen Stewart from the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. Thank you so much.
It is 7 minutes to 7. Were young people missold their student loans? That's a question people who took out what's called a Plan 2 student loan, which started after fees went up in 2012, are now asking with increasing volume. Kate Ogden is a research economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, who's told us a bit more about the student loan system at the moment.
The terms that apply to student loans have changed a lot over the years, even for those who started courses quite recently. So for those who started courses in 2022, we estimate that they might have expected to repay about £40,000 on average over their lifetimes. Given all the changes that have happened since 2022, we now expect these graduates to repay around £55,000 on average, so £15,000 more than when they might have made the decision to go to university. An unusual feature of these loans is that the interest added depends on how much a graduate earns. For higher earners, this high interest rate is likely to mean they make repayments for longer, potentially for many more years, and that they repay substantially more overall.
Listening to that, and joining us now, Claire Barrett, consumer editor for the Financial Times. Claire, good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Some may think they've always been doing that, but what's the key difference here?
Well, I think what's really motivated graduates to start campaigning about this. There's a big campaign on the internet called Rethink Repayment that lots of people have noticed in the last few weeks, is the November budget. Now, the Chancellor said the salary threshold where you start repaying your Plan 2 student loan, that's for those who started uni roughly in the decade after 2012, it's just over £29,000 at the moment. And what you earn over that is taxed at 9%. But in the budget, the Chancellor said that threshold's going to be frozen for 3 years from April, after which it rises with inflation again. So anyone who's listening to this, who's working and thinking they're feeling like they're paying more tax than usual, fiscal drag, as we call it, Well, the students, the graduates, feel that they're subject to double fiscal drag. So we've already had income tax thresholds frozen. Now that student loan threshold is being frozen. So the loan repayments at 9% or higher, if they did a postgraduate loan potentially, they're taken from a much bigger slice of their pay. And students are finding that this is really demotivating for them at a time when we've got the cost of living crisis, inflation is still rising, and this extended freeze means more and more of them are waking up to the fact that, you know, this is not a loan, it's working like a graduate tax, and it's a tax that they're going to be paying for 30 years until the loan is wiped under the current rules, because with all the rule changes, lots of them are worried that rule might change in the future. So they just feel like, one of them described it to me as a debt sentence. They just feel that in the cost of living squeeze, with the fiscal drag, the tax thresholds, with really high rents in the private sector, because many of them can't afford to save and get a housing deposit together, they're just stuck.
What would you say to, just looking at what the money saving expert Martin Lewis outlined recently on this? He said the amount you borrow is mostly irrelevant day to day. It works more like a tax, like you're saying there. But in practice, what happens is you effectively pay an extra 9% tax on your income for 40 years. Many get irate about the interest, but in reality, student loans have no real cost to them. Some may not pay any interest at all. You only ever roughly repay what it costs to pay for the same goods in the future, not more, as the interest only increases at the same rate as prices. You know, while many graduates will be charged interest, some won't actually pay any interest at all. What do you say around that?
Yeah, we're slightly talking about two different things here. I mean, the level of interest being charged on student loans is high compared to mortgages. Yes. You know, it's the retail price index plus 3%. So some people are being charged 6.2% interest on that, on their loans. And that is demotivating because they're making payments from their salary, quite big payments, they feel like. And the balance is still going up because the interest rate is high. Now, that is, I agree with Martin, you know, you kind of almost don't want to worry about the overall numbers, because the impact on you is going to be that 9% above a threshold of tax that's coming out of your salary to repay your loan. Now, the big problem we have at the moment is that that's interacting with existing cliff edges in the tax system, the £50,000 mark where higher rate tax kicks in, £60,000 where child benefit, if you're a parent, starts to be tapered away, £100,000 where you lose your personal allowance. So if you're somebody who's also repaying a student loan, then, you know, you could see maybe 70 pence or more in the pound deducted from your salary above a certain level. And that's what's demotivating graduates from taking on more work or trying to get a promotion.
We're going to hear from a graduate and an MP affected by this in the next hour. Claire Barrett, thank you.
The money from your dad's life insurance came through.
Dad was my best friend.
You really should have friends your own age.
On BBC iPlayer.
How are you alive?
It turns out I hadn't died.
This is fraud. You can go to prison. Your dad might not be dead physically, but emotionally, he's been gone since the 90s.
One little lie, one massive mess.
Come on, we're being blackmailed. What sort of friend blackmails her own mates?
Can you keep a secret?
We're a code red.
Get back in the house, you human, I'm dead.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Now for the weather, is Simon King.
Emma, thanks so much indeed. Across England and Wales, it's a rather cloudy, damp start today. We've got some rain and some drizzle out there. And for many parts, there's not going to be a great deal of change as the day goes on. But I want to just draw your attention to southeast Wales through parts of Somerset and Devon, where the rain is going to be more persistent and heavier here. And there's the risk of some flooding through into this afternoon. Maximum temperatures across England and Wales, about 7 to 10 degrees Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, it's largely dry this morning, but rain becomes heavier, more widespread and persistent, and again that could lead to some flooding through today with highs of 8 to 10 Celsius. And across Scotland, again very wet this morning. It's in eastern Scotland where there's particular concern because the rain's been here for the last 24 hours and it's going to continue for the next 24 hours, so really high rainfall totals, and especially around Grampian, Angus, Perth and Kinross, where there's an amber warning from the Met Office, some flooding here. Strong winds as well across northeastern Scotland, temperatures of 4 to 8 Celsius.
Simon, thank you so much. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 22nd of January. The headlines. European leaders are waiting to find out more about President Trump's potential deal over Greenland, which has seen him lift his threat of tariffs and the use of force to take the territory. What exactly could such a deal look like? Who will be the winners and losers? We'll bring you analysis throughout the programme from the US, from Europe, and we'll speak to the Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, after 8 o'clock. Rescue teams are searching for several people missing after a landslide engulfed a campsite in New Zealand. The families of patients who suffered or died after they caught infections in Scotland's largest hospital have accused NHS bosses of deceit and cowardice as the public inquiry draws to a close.
And coming up in the next hour, we've heard from some of the adults in the UK. Now it's time for the kids to have their say. What do they make of us potentially following Australia and going for a possible ban on social media for under 16s?
Feel kind of disappointed with myself when I'm just scrolling and scrolling. I'm just wasting away the time that I could have had spending time with friends or doing something productive.
There you go. I think a lot of us can relate to that. You will hear more of that discussion at 7:30. And with soaring interest rates on student loans, as we were just discussing, were students missold their part of the deal? We'll hear just before 8 o'clock from a graduate who's not incentivised to earn any more, it seems, at the moment, and an MP struggling with the issue. But first, the BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
President Trump has said that a possible deal covering the future of Greenland would achieve everything he wants and last forever, after rowing back on threats to seize the island by force or levy further tariffs on European allies who oppose his desire to own it. Mr. Trump announced he'd agreed what he called the framework of a future deal after talks at the World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos, but gave few details. Our North America editor Sarah Smith is following developments.
Donald Trump began his visit to Davos by insisting that the US needed to acquire Greenland for reasons of national security, saying, "You need the ownership to defend it." Then a matter of hours later, he used a social media post to announce that he and the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte had agreed the framework of a deal over Greenland. If consummated, he wrote, it would be a great solution for the US and all NATO nations. As a result, he said he would not impose tariffs on European allies. It is hard to see how Donald Trump can claim this as a victory when it does not appear that he will achieve his stated aim of taking full control of Greenland. One of the officials who attended the meeting has told the New York Times that Denmark could grant the US sovereignty over small pockets of land where military bases could be built. The idea is said to be based on the sovereign British bases in Cyprus.
Mark Rutte has said he did not discuss Danish sovereignty over Greenland during his meeting with President Trump yesterday. The Secretary General of NATO described the talks as very good, but warned there was still a lot of work to be done. Here's our Europe correspondent, Nick Beek.
Mark Rutte was widely lampooned after referring to Donald Trump as daddy in praise of his ability to strong-arm the NATO family into boosting their defence spending. But it seems the Secretary-General has now helped initiate the mother of all climb-downs as the President tears up his latest tariff threat. European leaders are digesting what was a tumultuous few hours in Davos yesterday. Denmark's foreign minister said the day had ended on a better note than it began. The deputy prime minister of Sweden, Ebba Busch, told the BBC's Newsnight the relationship between the EU and US had been damaged and now was the time for Europe to toughen up. EU leaders are to meet in Brussels this evening in what was convened as an emergency summit to respond to a crisis that threatened to blow apart the transatlantic alliance. The tension has now eased, but this is far from a problem solved.
President Trump has said President Putin has agreed to join his Board of Peace initiative. Mr. Putin has not confirmed this. Earlier, he said the Russian Foreign Ministry was still studying the invitation. Mr. Trump is planning a signing ceremony for the board in Davos later this morning. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
The Board of Peace was originally unveiled by the White House as part of a mechanism for the future governance of Gaza. It now appears to have morphed into something more like a rival to the United Nations. Its proposed charter, which makes no reference to Gaza, says the board will be an international organization that promotes stability and secures peace in areas of conflict. Countries wanting to join as permanent members will be asked to cough up $1 billion in cash. Donald Trump will serve as inaugural chairman and designate his own successor. So far, only around 16 countries have agreed to join. Yesterday, 8 of them, including Turkey, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, issued a joint statement saying they endorsed the aim of consolidating a permanent ceasefire in Gaza and advancing the Palestinian right to statehood. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who adamantly opposes a Palestinian state, says he's also willing to join.
For more analysis of President Trump's visit to Davos, you can listen to Americast wherever you get your podcasts. Several people, including children, are missing after a landslide at a campsite on the North Island of New Zealand. It happened at the popular tourist destination of Mount Maunganui after days of torrential rain. Our correspondent Katie Watson is following the story from Sydney.
One survivor said it was like being in a movie, a tourist town with a volcano and a huge landslide barreling towards some hot baths by a campsite, wiping out tents, caravans and a toilet block. It's peak summer in New Zealand, the last week of school holidays for many kids, and the campsite was busy. Authorities earlier said it was still a rescue situation, and another two people are missing after a landslide damaged a house in Welcome Bay, about half an hour's drive from the campsite. Much of the east coast of the North Island has been hit by bad weather in recent days. Some parts of the region saw as much rain in 12 hours as they would normally in a month, with New Zealand's Minister of Emergency Management, Mark Mitchell, comparing the damage to a war zone.
Families of patients who suffered or died after they caught infections in Scotland's largest hospital have said they were lied to, demeaned and smeared. An inquiry into patient safety at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital campus in Glasgow is hearing closing submissions this week. It was set up after the deaths of several children and adults. Our Scotland editor James Cook reports from Glasgow.
For years, NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde denied that water and ventilation failings were responsible for infections and deaths on the Glasgow Hospital campus, which opened in 2015. But in closing submissions to the Scottish Hospitals Inquiry, the Health Board issued a dramatic apology, admitting it was likely that some infections were caused by problems with the water system. In a statement issued by their lawyers this morning, the majority of the affected families accused the board of deceit and conniving cowardice, saying they had been lied to, disbelieved, demeaned and smeared. They demanded accountability for what they called despicable incompetence and claimed the hospital was still not safe. The NHS insists it is. The inquiry is expected to issue its report later this year. A criminal investigation into several deaths at the campus is also underway.
Teaching unions are calling for more guidance to help parents make sure their children are ready to start school. A survey by the early years charity Kindred Squared suggests more than a quarter of those who joined reception classes across England and Wales last year weren't toilet trained. The government has set a target for 75% of children to be school ready by 2028. Ellie Price reports.
Children who are considered school-ready are expected to have basic language skills, to be able to eat, go to the toilet and dress themselves independently, and to be able to sit, play and listen. This survey of 1,000 primary school staff suggested 37% of 4- and 5-year-olds starting school last year weren't ready. Just over a quarter weren't toilet trained. The survey also suggested around 28% of children didn't know how to use books correctly. The government says it inherited a system where disadvantage was allowed to deepen, and although there were early signs of improvement, it acknowledged there was further to go.
The accounting firm Deloitte has published its annual list of the world's richest football clubs, with Manchester United falling to their lowest ever position. They're still one of six English clubs in the top 10, but it's aside from Spain's La Liga that's out in front financially, as Joe Linsky reports.
These figures show the value for clubs in playing more fixtures. Manchester United have no European football this season and have been knocked out of two domestic competitions. That's partly why they've dropped for the first time to eighth in the Deloitte Money League. They're now the fourth richest Premier League club, behind Liverpool, Manchester City and Arsenal, while Real Madrid sit at the top, the first team to record revenue over £1 billion. Deloitte say the richest clubs now are those offering more to fans, even on days the teams aren't playing. But as debate in this sport continues around player welfare, it's clear that more matches equals more money.
Joe Linsky reporting. Caroline, thank you. It's 9 minutes past seven. Donald Trump claims to have got what he wanted when it comes to what he describes as his big, beautiful piece of ice, Greenland, dropping his threat to invade the Danish territory. The announcement of sorts came after a meeting with NATO in which some sort of framework of a future deal regarding control of the Arctic island has been agreed, which President Trump claims is vital for American security. Also gone, the threat of tariffs on eight allies, including the UK, after that meeting, which the US leader called very productive. After a tempestuous fortnight which has seen President Trump repeatedly threaten his allies over the Danish territory and potentially shatter the North Atlantic alliance, could it all be sorted? But what are the details? Who blinked? The New York Times quotes anonymous officials saying one idea is for Denmark to cede sovereignty over small areas of Greenland where the US would build military bases. I've been asking Ezra Cohen, the former Undersecretary for Defence during the first Trump administration, what could have been agreed to please President Trump.
The president has given actually some hints following his remarks at Davos and his meeting with the NATO Secretary General. And he has said that the U.S. will have permanent control of some amount of territory in Greenland for the purposes of establishing a U.S. defensive umbrella over our hemisphere.
We're waiting, as you say, for details. That there are hints, there are ways, I suppose, of guessing to what this could be. But that is some way from how it has been sounding and what he seemed to be saying he wanted. What do you say to those who say that the European leaders are standing together, saying we won't tolerate this? They've forced a back down from Trump.
Well, I think the president was engaged in a high stakes international negotiation, and he set out the maximalist position. And at the end of the day, though, it appears, and again, like you said, we don't know exactly, but it appears that he got actually what he wanted, which was the ability to have permanent control over parts of Greenland territory for the purposes of establishing the Golden Dome and other and also protecting other American national security interests.
I suppose I asked that question in the sense of power and the limits of power and how the European leaders will be receiving this. I mean, some have used the word resistance.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unfortunate that that some in Europe are trying to stoke this sort of conflict when really this is just a diplomatic negotiation. But at the end of the day,
it's not really a diplomatic. I mean, I know he said he wouldn't use force, but it was also seen as something that, it came off the back of what happened in Venezuela, and was Trump, keeping going with an aggressive foreign policy, as they would see it.
Well, look, coercion is one tactic in a negotiation. But the president, as he laid out in his speech at Davos, came in and the United States has a very, very strong hand right now, both economically, but also militarily. And at the end of the day, Europe, and this has been echoed by many, Europe does not have the force posture or the resourcing today to adequately defend Greenland.
There will be some who look at this. I mean, there's that acronym TACO, Trump always chickens out, that he, you know, he pushed and he knew that he couldn't get as much as he wanted. And yet it's interesting you characterize it as he will have got exactly what he was asking for.
Right. Well, again, I mean, his objective was to get just enough to be able to satisfy the American defensive needs. On top of that, there's also indications that he will, that the U.S. will get certain natural resources rights as well.
I was very struck the other day by one analyst talking about the fact that it sometimes at the moment it feels Trump treats his allies worse than his enemies. And the threats of tariffs, you know, hasn't worked in this instance, or rather he hasn't gone there in this instance. It was a threat in the end. But I wonder what damage, from the American perspective, I know America in a very strong position in many ways, as you've described, but what do you make of the potential damage that does?
Well, I mean, you know, just like with the Iran strike and also the Venezuela action, the president has shown that he is really only needs to use the exact amount of force or the exact amount of, you know, diplomatic pressure as he sees fit, right? And that you see the same thing here. He employed the tactics that were just enough to get what he wanted. He didn't go overboard. You know, in the end, the tariffs weren't necessary. In the end, and as he said, you know, I could use military force, but that's not going to be necessary. And he wouldn't do it.
Ezra Cohen, thank you very much. Listening to that is Sarah Smith, our North America editor. Sarah, we were just hearing here, whatever Donald Trump has managed to secure, which Ezra Cohen was going along with what's certainly been reported in the New York Times, that some parts of Greenland will be going to America, if I put it like that, in the broadest sense, or come under American control, it will be of great benefit to NATO. What do you make of that analysis?
Well, that's certainly what Donald Trump has been saying all along, that it's necessary for the United States to control, well, he said all of Greenland, but parts of Greenland for national security purposes. But I don't think anybody else in the NATO alliance is going to see it that way, because what has been revealed, one of the things that's been revealed during this spat, is the contempt Donald Trump has for some of his NATO allies and the alliance itself. He even said in his speech to Davos that he wasn't convinced that any of America's NATO allies would come to its defense if required to. And he complained again and again about how much more money the US spends on security and defense than other NATO allies. And so, as well as the damage that has been done to close friends when you threaten them with economic punishment in the forms of tariffs, and won't even rule out until his speech yesterday the threat of force against a NATO ally, you also have him reiterating his position that he has no value for the NATO alliance in the first place. And that's a very difficult place in which to, in order to go on with your allies trying to make this work. And of course, it's fairly typical of Donald Trump to announce that he has achieved a successful deal before the details have been worked out and before we know actually whether or not it is indeed a workable deal.
Sarah Smith there. Well, let's get the Danish perspective now with Christian Friisbak, chairman of Denmark's Foreign Affairs Committee. Mr. Friisbak, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Do you feel that Europe has rallied behind Denmark this week?
We've seen strong European solidarity, and this is very much appreciated. And I think this is part of what we're seeing now. Luckily, the military threat seems to be gone, and the tariff threat has been taken off the table as well. And this is good news. I'm sure they have slept well in Greenland this night compared to what they have done the last month or so.
Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, but I think it's important to say that there's no agreement. You know, there's nothing about Greenland without Greenland at the table, and Greenland and Denmark was not at the table. But I hope what we see is what Denmark has been proposing, namely an Arctic sentry based on, mirrored on what we have done in the Baltic Sea with the Baltic sentry, which is a deployment by NATO combined of perhaps ships, vessels, mine hunters, patrol, aircraft, radar sensors, all of it together to provide better surveillance and security right. in the Arctic region. And I think this is what Denmark has proposed Monday in our meetings with the NATO Secretary General, and I hope this is the outcome of the meeting. And this is a very welcome step.
So what do you say, Mr. Friesbeck, to those who argue that by using tariffs, President Trump has got something of what he wanted, in that Denmark has been required to make promises, as you describe them, on Arctic security that it otherwise wouldn't?
Well, there's no kind of acquisition of territory or handing over of territory in this, but there's an open door for increased American presence, military presence in the Arctic and in Greenland. And this has been open since 1951.
Yes.
The Americans just have to ask. They haven't asked for 20 years. Now we see an interest. Denmark is willing, Greenland is willing to take this positively and respond to it.
Okay.
And if it's done within a NATO framework, it's even better. And this seems, I hope, to be the outcome of yesterday's meeting. So it's a positive outcome. And if this is the case, an Arctic century, it is needed. It is something Greenland and Denmark welcome.
Okay, can I ask you to address something that President Trump said in his letter to the Norwegian Prime Minister earlier this week? Obviously, that letter has been overtaken by circumstances. But he said Denmark cannot protect that land, i.e. Greenland, from Russia or China. He went on to say, why do they have a right of ownership anyway? There are no written documents. It's only that a boat landed there hundreds of years ago, but we had boats landing there also. Let's just take the start of that. On the assertion from President Trump that Denmark cannot protect that land, Greenland, from Russia or China, is that true?
But NATO can. And Denmark and Greenland, we are part of NATO. No country in Europe can protect itself, And when the US went to Afghanistan, they wanted our help, and we came. And so this is how it is. And NATO can do it, and we are joining hands in NATO, and Denmark have scaled up our military presence already together with NATO allies, European. I hope the Americans will join, and this is where will be a welcome development. And unfortunately, I have to run this.
Of course, you've got another interview with Danish television.
A little bit delayed, yeah,
you're
sorry about
highly
this,
in demand. Well, I hope we get the chance to speak again in the future, and we very much appreciate your time. And the message that Denmark can't, but NATO can, is heard loud and clear. Mr. Friesbeck, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Christian Friesbeck, the chairman of Denmark's Foreign Affairs Committee.
And at 20 past seven, we'll come back to that story shortly, but we're moving our attention to business because we're getting increasing evidence from the high street that shoppers delayed their spending over the key festive period, with the discount retailer The Works the latest flagging the trend. Will Bain has more on that. Hi, Will.
Hi again, Emma. Yes, perhaps one of our most recognisable retailers, with its 500 plus stores around the country selling books, arts and crafts and stationery. They've just released their latest financial results, and the chief executive, Gavin Peck, joins us. Morning, Gavin.
Morning, Will.
That trend then, because you kind of split the results up here. The run up to Christmas, sort of in October, November, December, a bit weaker, but actually a big sort of rush in that last bit, December and into the early part of January.
Yeah, I think it's been a challenging backdrop, as you say, but overall we're pleased with the picture. We've delivered strong sales growth in our stores. It did come late in December.
What do you put that down to, the kind of lateness? Can you put your finger on it?
I think it's just consumers are still very fragile in terms of their confidence and their spend. So I think they're watching every penny that they spend, waiting for deals. At the last minute, we saw a strong November with our Black November discounts. And then, yeah, customers really waited till the end to see if retailers would further discount.
Interested in the kind of shift that you've made as a company. You've really kind of pivoted to talk, really emphasise, haven't you, in all your branding, that you are a sort of non-screen and away from screen type of business. And given what we're talking about today on the programme, I know Amol's going to be talking to some young users later about social media. Are you seeing that actually come through from a business perspective, that people are seeking you out to buy colouring books or whatever it is to get their kids away from screens?
Yeah, it's reflected in our sales growth. I think we're seeing two things. There is the growing evidence of the negative impact of too much screen time and what people are doing on those screens, particularly children, which obviously the government announced a review of social media for under 16s earlier in the week. And also, just anecdotally, in our own research, in the summer holidays, 40% of parents wanted to limit screen time, but they wanted practical alternatives for that. So, you know, we're here offering alternative feel-good ways to connect away from screens.
And is it making business sense? Is it working? I mean, it's clearly an obvious strategy. Is it driving revenue?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we've increased our store sales ahead of the non-food market, and we've improved our profitability in the first half and on track for the full year expectations. So it's a huge part of our strategy.
The backdrop going forward then in the year ahead as well, Gavin. We heard from Martin Ingham earlier in the kind of hospitality sector. A lot to talk about business rates. Rachel Reeves now saying it's going to be pubs only first of all. You guys in retail have been looking for a bit of support there as well. Disappointment that it's not going to cover you as well?
Yeah, I understand the Chancellor's under pressure to improve finances and has a difficult job, but you know, we've been promised for some time a fundamental change and that hasn't happened. And you know, ultimately, it's going to negatively impact on communities. We want thriving towns and cities that give employment, socialisation.
And an impact on you at the works?
Yeah, we have got cost headwinds as everyone else has, but we've got strength in growing our sales and cutting our costs elsewhere. So we'll just have to continue with that as we have been doing with the cost headwinds we've had for several years now.
But the business rates needs looking at in the whole.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Gavin Peck, the Chief Executive of The Works, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Will, thank you. It's 23 minutes past seven from business and screen-free focus there to the big screen, the silver screen. Oscar nominations will be announced later. Leonardo DiCaprio's politically charged thriller. I've not seen it, but that's how it's described. One battle after another is expected to lead the field. Anna Smith is the former president of the UK Critics Circle and the host of Girls on Film podcast and a film critic who can help us out. Anna, good morning.
Good morning.
Any surprises in here? The runners, the riders, why should we care?
Well, I mean, it's a really big deal in the film industry, of course, the Oscars, and it does give us a good indication of what films are terrific and good to watch. I mean, One Battle After Another, you mentioned there, has been doing well with audiences and critics, and it's a very strong contender, I think. It's a gripping film. We're likely to see it do very well across all the acting categories, which isn't always the case. And I think, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson is definitely in the frame for Best Director. Another film to look out for is Hamnet, of course. A lot of people are talking about that, going to see it, finding it very moving. It's also highly nominated at the Girls on Film Awards. It's just won two Golden Globes for Best Picture Drama and Best Actress. Jessie Buckley is tremendous in this film. So I
Which
think
apparently you need two sets of tissues for, I was told by the writer the other day when they had just won big again. Sorry, carry on.
At least two sets of tissues, in my view, yeah. It's a deeply moving film. And it's also interesting because it takes a different look at a life of a very well-loved person in history, Shakespeare, who we've seen so often come up in films in awards season. But this is a different perspective, so I really loved it for that.
Any big British stars or producers expected to be garlanded or at least nominated?
Well, it's possibly more of an American year this year. I mean, we could certainly see some Brits in the acting categories. You know, Cynthia Erivo might be up for Best Actress for Wicked. And there's certainly some Brits in the technical categories and so on. But I think it's interesting that we're looking at things like Sinners as well is a really big talking point. And this could actually be one of the most nominated films. So that's the kind of sort of vampire horror that we've seen, which takes on a lot of themes to do with race. It's a real mix of genres, and because it's also got some original songs in it, it's got the potential to be nominated in a lot of different categories. So Sinners is another big one to look for, but also Felicity Jones on the British front, we might see her pop up for the lovely film Train Dreams. There are a few quieter films that will be really interesting to see if they're nominated.
Just in terms of where I mentioned there, you know, the relevance of the Oscars, of course, massive in your world, massive in the film world, and is a very good thing just to be able to say, I'm going to, you know, spend the money, the increasing amount of money it costs to go to the cinema. If I still do that, I don't want to see something I won't love. So as a predictor of what you might enjoy, although sometimes that can be a bit off. I ask it as well because obviously there is this move of the Oscars going onto YouTube. And I wonder if that reflects a concern around whether it remains relevant.
Yeah, there's long been that sort of problem that, you know, not as many people are tuning in to watch the Oscars, younger people. That's not the way they tend to view things. Fewer people are having the sort of all night parties where they stay up and watch it. And it has been trying to stay relevant with younger generations for a while. So but I think it's in the recent years, perhaps it's doing a little bit better, partly because a lot of people are putting clips onto YouTube and you get a lot of memes and sort of comedic moments coming out of it. And I think it's having a bit of a resurgence of interest in that way.
We shall see. And certainly you've not made full predictions there, but we'll see if they measure up and stand up to it. Anna Smith, thank you very much talking to us there ahead of those Oscar nominations being announced later.
27 minutes past seven. Mike is here with the sport. Hi, Mike.
Hello again, Amal. Let's reflect further, shall we, on another busy night in the Champions League, starting in the south of France, where the forgotten man of Liverpool made his long-awaited return.
The big team news tonight, there's no doubt about it, it's the return of Mo Salah. His first appearance for Liverpool in well over a month. Things weren't going so well around the time when he set off for the Africa Cup of Nations. The likes of
Yes, Mo Salah was back for Liverpool last night, making his first start since November. No goal or assist for the Egyptian, but he did play the full 90 minutes in a 3-0 victory over Marseille, where we heard commentator Conor McNamara there describing the scenes at the Stade Velodrome, and he joins us now. Morning, Conor.
Good morning, Mike.
So Salah is back. What sort of game did he have? And the big question, I guess, is his very public falling out with manager Arne Slot last year now all forgotten?
Yeah, there was much anticipation to see if first of all, Arne Slot would put Mo Salah straight back into the team last night. There had been friction, as you say. Salah had been a little bit peripheral in the weeks leading up to his departure to go to Morocco. But secondly, how would he integrate back in with his teammates? And the good news for Liverpool is that it all went well. Salah worked hard. And I think the new signings, Wirtz, Kerkez, Frimpong, they've all settled down into their roles in recent weeks. It felt like a more cohesive Liverpool team that Salah returned to last night.
And it was a good night all round, Conor, wasn't it, for the English clubs, who appeared to have done their homework in analysing their opponents.
Yes, Liverpool's opening goal last night came from a very clever free kick. Now, analysis of opponents has become a key factor, and we've all become very familiar in the Premier League when a team is defending a free kick to see them deploy what's become known as the draft excluder, one of the defending players lying down on the ground behind his teammates in the wall. Well, last night Liverpool's analysis noticed that Marseille don't use this draft excluder system, so Szoboszlai cleverly rolled the ball under the jumping wall and very simply into the net. In a similar vein, Newcastle noticed that PSV Eindhoven play these risky short passes out from the back, and Eddie Howe's team pounced on that. Johan Vissers got his first Champions League goal, Harvey Barnes scored, and Anthony Gordon as well, who's now up to 6 in his 7 Champions League game this season.
And just a brief word on Chelsea. First European match in charge for their new manager, Liam Rossinia, last night. Slightly underwhelming against Paphos at Stamford Bridge, but a 1-0 win keeps them in the mix for a top eight finish.
Yeah, though, they made hard work of it. The winning goal from Casado came in the 78th minute. Loads of chances spurned before that. It leaves Chelsea 8th in the table, 8 being the magic number. The top 8 teams in this format avoid the playoffs. They go straight through to the last 16. Apart from Manchester City, who lost in Norway on Tuesday, it's otherwise been a very good week for the English teams. It emphasises the strength of the Premier League. Arsenal, Liverpool, Spurs, Newcastle, Chelsea, 5 English teams inside those top 8 spots for now. City just 1 point outside, and there's 1 game left to play next week.
Should mention Harry Kane as well last night. Scored twice, missed the penalty as 10-man Bayern Munich secured their place in the last 16. But Conor McNamara, many thanks for rounding up all of the European action. Just time quickly to head to Melbourne, day 5 of the Australian Open tennis. No Brits in action today, but Abigail Johnson is watching the women's world number 2, Iga Świątek, who looks like is on the brink of victory, Abigail.
Yeah, match point for Iga Świątek on John Cain Arena, the third show court. She is targeting the career Grand Slam at this tournament, Świątek, and would do well to keep Marie Bouchkova to the straight set scoreline. She's hoping to join Wimbledon finalist Amanda Anisimova, defending champion Madison Keys, and 10-time champion Novak Djokovic, and progressing in straight sets to the third round today. Also got eyes on Stan Wawrinka on Kia Arena. He's in his final Australian Open, the 40-year-old, and he is down 2-1 against Artur Geyer, but plenty of support for him on the court where he picked up his first Australian Open win in 5 years 2 days ago.
Thank you, Abigail. Live in Melbourne, coverage of the Australian Open continues on BBC Sounds. And just to say, in the next hour of this programme, ahead of England's one day against Sri Lanka later this morning, speaking to someone who has a very big future, it's predicted, with the England side, England batter Jacob Bethel is my guest in the next hour.
Look forward to that. And coming up on Radio 4 next week, something else very good for you indeed.
There's so much evidence behind fibre.
The data cannot be argued with.
It's one of the most impactful things we can do for our health.
How much do you really know about fibre?
It's ironic, isn't it? Because it is good for you, it is not seen as being a pleasure or a treat.
Join me, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, for a new series, Discovering What Fibre Can Do For Us.
Somebody in this family has been undermining my mission.
Buying white pasta behind my back.
The Fibre Factor. Next Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is real heartwarming comfort food.
What a good way to eat beans.
Quick look at the weather today. Northeastern Scotland will see heavy, persistent rain continue, particularly in the morning. Rain turning to snow on the hills later.
And coming up after the news, ban social media for teens in this country. We'll hear from three of them to get their views, and they'll properly go there, I'm told.
They certainly will. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan. It's 28 minutes to 8. Here's a summary of the news from Caroline Nichols.
President Trump has said that a possible deal aimed at ensuring security in the Arctic would, in his words, put everybody in a good position, after he rode back on plans to take Greenland by force or impose tariffs on European allies. The Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, has said that provided there's respect for her country's territorial integrity, Greenland and Denmark would continue discussions with the US. President Trump has said that President Putin has agreed to join his Board of Peace, a body which aims to resolve international conflicts. But the Russian leader has not yet confirmed his acceptance of the invitation. Mr. Trump is planning a signing ceremony for the organisation's charter in Davos later. Rescuers in New Zealand are searching for several people, including children, who are missing after a landslide at a campsite on the North Island. Tons of mud buried a shower block and hit multiple caravans at the grounds which lie at the foot of Mount Maunganui. Official figures show that the UK government borrowing slowed to £11.6 billion last month as tax receipts outweighed an increase in spending. That's below the £13 billion most economists had been forecasting. Families of patients who suffered or died after they caught infections in Scotland's largest hospital have said they were lied to, demeaned and smeared. An inquiry into patient safety at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital campus in Glasgow is hearing closing submissions this week. NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde has since admitted that the complex, which was opened in 2015, faced design flaws and infections were probably linked to issues with the hospital water system. Teaching unions are calling for more support to help families prepare their children for primary school. The early years charity Kindred Squared said a survey had suggested more than a third of children started school in England and Wales last year, not having the basic life skills to engage with the curriculum.
Caroline, thank you so much. It's 26 minutes to 8. What do the kids think? What do our kids think about a ban on social media for under-16s? The House of Lords has voted in favour of banning under-16s from social media, passing a proposal brought forward by the Conservative peer Lord Nash. The measure will now return to the Commons, where MPs can vote to overturn it if they wish. Some campaigners are sceptical, saying a ban would be difficult to enforce, merely pushing kids to darker, less regulated platforms, that it amounts to surveillance and censorship, and that we should in fact celebrate and optimise the power of the internet rather than keeping it away from our progeny. Sir Keir Starmer has said all options are on the table. We wanted to speak to some Year 8s to hear what they made of a potential ban. Sophia, Faith and Alex are all 12 years old and they're students in Year 8 at a school in Sunderland. I asked Faith how she would feel if her phone, with her social media on it, was taken away.
I'd feel quite, like, sad because I wouldn't be able to chat to my friends anymore and I wouldn't be able to send, like, funny memes or anything.
How much of your time do you spend sending funny memes to your mates?
Usually, like, about 10 minutes.
Alex, can I ask you what you think about a ban?
I think the ban is somewhat fair due to the existence of AI. And using this AI, people are making slop and other content so that people can, like, get fixated on it and know what's actually real or not.
Do you feel that you're exposed very much, Faith, to kind of bad stuff that you wish you hadn't seen? Do you ever see something and think, oh, God, I wish I hadn't seen that?
There is some things out there that I've been exposed to and I don't particularly like it, and I think it's quite disgusting and just it's not what people our age should be seeing, and it's just terrible.
So, Sophia, do you ever wish that more was done to try and protect children your age, which is 12, from those really horrible images?
I think if there's images of AI bots and that on comments and that, it should be took down.
If you're really, really honest, Do you think that ban would work? Or do you think other people that you know, maybe even yourself sometimes if you're tempted, would find a way to get around the ban and still use social media? What do you think, Sophia?
I think there will still be people that will find a way around and will use social media still. But then some people will just accept the fact that they cannot do it and not bother.
Alex, what about you?
I'd say it'd certainly reduce, but with the existence of VPNs and irresponsible parents, then there'll be the small minority of people who can still scroll.
That's so interesting you know that. So a VPN is a virtual private network. What do you know about virtual private networks, Alex? Because you probably know more than most people, more than me. What do you know about them and how you can use them?
You can bypass rules. For example, if you're not allowed to, like, if you're not allowed to, like, speak in something, or, like, speak in, like, a virtual game, then you can maybe get a VPN in order to bypass it.
Right, exactly, yeah. And, you know, one of the things people have said about a ban is that if there was a ban on the big platforms, people you know your age might just go to other platforms. Faith, do you think that's a potential problem?
I think it would be a problem as well, because if it's, like, a different version of it, then I don't think that the safety platforms would be as high as what they are on high streaming apps.
Okay. You know, it's interesting. All of you guys, when I started out, mentioned TikTok straight away. If you're really, really honest, and I want you to be really honest with me here, would you say that sometimes you people could say, and I'll start with you, Faith, that TikTok is quite addictive and that you're maybe a bit addicted to TikTok? What do you reckon, Faith?
I think it is addicting because you're just scrolling for hours, and under every scroll there's always a new video, so you're just constantly just going through that cycle of scrolling and scrolling.
I'd say that if you go into a short, since I don't have TikTok or anything, if you go into a short, you get shorter attention span, so you want to just scroll and scroll and scroll without anticipation.
And are you worried that the shorts on YouTube, Alex, are having an effect on your attention span, your ability to concentrate for long periods of time and really focus?
I see it somewhat does that.
Okay. Do you sometimes find, Sophia, that, you know, you've been on your phone for an hour and you just kind of went in there to look at something, and before you know it, like, an hour's gone and you've just been messaging friends and an hour's just completely disappeared?
Yeah, it happens quite frequently.
Yeah, what do you say to that, Faith? Do you ever have that where you're looking at one particular thing and then before you know it, you've kind of been sucked in and suddenly an hour of your time's disappeared?
That happens to us more than you'd know.
Go on, what do you mean by that, Faith? Go on.
So I could, like, go on TikTok to, like, look at a video of what my friend sent, and then all of a sudden, like, 2 hours have gone by on a Saturday and I've just been, like, watching just TikTok videos go by and by, and I haven't even looked at the one that they've sent us.
How do you feel about that, Faith? When you think, you guys, I can tell you as a very old man, I'm in my 40s now, being young is so incredible. You've got so much time to do such wonderful things, to discover the world, to pursue ideas, to meet people, have fun. How do you feel about that idea that, as you say, you could just sort of lose 2 hours of your Saturday doing something that, as you describe, is pretty kind of mindless? You didn't even look at the original video they sent you, just did something else for 2 hours. How do you feel about that?
I'm not quite sure. I just feel kind of disappointed with myself when I'm just scrolling and scrolling. I'm just wasting away, like, the time that I could have had just, like, spending time with friends or doing something productive.
But, you know, you sound so, if I may say, all of you, you sound so smart and so wise and so, I guess I'd say, reflective. You guys obviously think about this a lot. Given what you just said there, Faith, given you know that 2 hours was wasted, what's to stop you just not doing it?
Set, like, a limit on my phone, like a, I don't know, like a 10-minute limit on a video that I could, like scrolling on TikTok or something. And then once the limit's up, I just, like, put my phone away and read or something.
Okay. We've talked a lot, guys, about the negatives. And, you know, they say about technology that it's all dual use, right? You can use it for bad or you can use it for good. Can I just talk to you about what good you guys get out of? And I don't mean by that you get lots of pleasure and entertainment and you get to communicate with your friends. But maybe in terms of discovery or learning things or pursuing passions or ideas, how do you, for instance, Alex, use YouTube Shorts for good? How does it make your life better?
So if you're, like, watching something about a game, or sometimes I scroll into Vsauce, For example, like Resource is very smart. He gives lots of advice and gives a lot of opinions about science. Obviously, you want something like Resource to stay.
So do you feel it can be a force for good?
Yes.
On TikTok, there's a section called STEM, where there's loads of videos about GCSE biology and maths and that to help you revise.
OK. If there was a ban, how would it affect your life and particularly your relationship with your friends? What about you, Alex? If you were honest, if there was a ban on social media, how would it change your life and your relationship with friends?
For a few days or maybe a week, it would feel like everything, and I mean absolutely everything's changed. Once I get over it, it feels like nothing, I guess.
And Sophia, what about you?
I think at first it'll be strange, and then once you're like a few weeks has passed by, it'll just be like how when we first got TikTok and how it's just adapted.
Okay. Have you all got your phones on you right now? Can you pull them out? And do you know how to check your screen time? Come on. I'm going to do it myself. And I'll be completely honest. I'm going to try and work it out. Okay. Mine's pretty serious. And I'm going to go last. Alex, what's your screen time saying?
I don't bring my phones to school, or I don't have them right now.
Okay. Sophia?
2 hours and 14 minutes.
Faith?
1 hour and 15 minutes.
Do you know what, guys? My daily screen time average, I'm actually ashamed to say, is 5 hours and 2 minutes. What do you think of that, Alex?
I'd say, don't know how to explain it. I have mixed feelings because you can do many things with a phone, so you don't know if you're doing it for good or doing it for bad.
I think it's good compared to other people because other people that I've seen on TikTok have got like 12 hours.
Wow. Okay. I mean, that is definitely too much. Do you know what? It makes me think that maybe the problem is not so much kids and social media, but adults and social media. Sophia, Faith and Alex, it's been such a pleasure and such a privilege chatting to you all. You're all so super smart. And I want to say both thank you and all the very best for your future, no matter how big a role social media plays in it. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Lovely and non-judgmental young people you
absolutely
found there, Amal. I would have
amazing
judged you if I'd met you at 16.
The team found them. They were amazing. I hope they
under 16, I should say.
Under 16. I hope the country...
Well, at 16 yeah minutes to 8, we'll change focus slightly because against the backdrop of a potential US-Greenland deal, which we've been trying to decode this morning a little and will continue to do so, we're talking to the Foreign Secretary after 8 o'clock, the Russian President Vladimir Putin is due to meet US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff today as the quest to find an end to the Russia-Ukraine war continues. Steve Rosenberg is our Russia editor. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
What do we know about this particular meeting and potentially how can you reflect on how events regarding Greenland have been watched in Russia and playing out there?
Well, as far as today's meeting in the Kremlin goes, yes, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, we believe, will be travelling to Russia later today for talks with Vladimir Putin. Few details about what, when or where. You know, the Russians often say, look, we're not into megaphone diplomacy. We don't like to say too much publicly. But in Davos, Steve Witkoff indicated that 90% of a peace deal was in place, and that a lot of progress had been made in the last few weeks. But of course, we've heard percentages being sort of bandied about before, and we've learned that a percentage sign kind of quoted in public does not guarantee an imminent peace deal. On Greenland, you know, it's interesting. I suspect that if President Biden or President Obama had come out and declared, we want Greenland, we must have Greenland, there would have been furious protests outside the US embassy in Moscow, you know, condemnation of US imperialism by Russian officials. What was Vladimir Putin's reaction yesterday? What's happening with Greenland, he said, is nothing to do with us. You know, in other words, Moscow's keeping out of this. And that is because Donald Trump is not Joe Biden or Barack Obama. He is a US president who doesn't lecture the Kremlin on democracy. A US president Vladimir Putin believes he can do deals with. And a US president, the Kremlin has concluded, is sympathetic, I think, to Russia's security concerns. I said Moscow's keeping out of it. Actually, it's not really. Russia's actually been stirring things a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, at a meeting of the Russian Security Council, President Putin was coming out with arguments that could be seen as actually supporting President Trump acquiring Greenland. He said, well, you know, the Americans bought Alaska from Russia in the 19th century. In other words, you know, nothing new here. And he even did the maths for him. He worked out how much Donald Trump would need to pay for Greenland. The Kremlin calculator came up with numbers ranging from $200 million up to $1 billion. And then he went on to slam Denmark for the way it's treated the people of Greenland. And what's interesting, there was even more encouragement for Donald Trump. A government paper earlier this week, it suggested that if he acquired Greenland, then President Trump would go down in history as a man who asserted the greatness of America, and it advised Mr. Trump not to back down from trying to take over the island and instead go for a swift annexation. And why all this encouragement? I think Moscow sees clearly all the pain, the stresses, the strains this whole Greenland saga has been putting on the Western alliance, on transatlantic relations, yes, on NATO, and it's really enjoying that.
Yes. Well, just talking about the future and stresses and strains, President Trump has said that President Putin has also agreed to join his board of peace. But what is the reaction at home? What do we know about Putin's position on this? Of course, a body that is intending to be there to resolve international conflicts.
Yeah, well, I mean, President Putin confirmed yesterday he's received an invitation to join. He hasn't accepted publicly yet. He said that the Russian foreign ministry is going to study the proposal and that Moscow is going to consult strategic partners before deciding. But even before it takes a decision, you know, Moscow has proposed that $1 billion worth of Russia's assets that were frozen in America be paid to the Board of Peace. There's been a kind of a mixed response in the Russian papers to this idea of a Board of Peace. Quite interesting. One tabloid this morning, Moskovsky Komsomolets, calls the Board of Peace Donald Trump's pocket UN and says you should be in no doubt that Trump will have the main say in what happens there, and that this Board of Peace is just one of a number of possibilities for a new world order. And goes on to say that as long as Russia secures victory in Ukraine, it doesn't matter at all to Moscow whether there's going to be a United Nations, a Board of Peace, or the League of Nations again. And there's another paper here, Nezavisima Gazeta, which doesn't sound optimistic about the idea at all. It says that the new world order hasn't formed yet. It's being born before our very eyes. And no one can say what it's going to be. Donald Trump's Board of Peace cannot guard the new world order because it doesn't exist yet, and says there is no alternative to the UN.
Steve Rosenberg, we'll have to leave it there. Our BBC Russia editor, thank you.
Worth just saying again, as a quick reminder, Justin and the team recorded an episode of Americast on this late last night. You can find that on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcast. Time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Jasveer Singh, co-chair of City Sikhs Charity and trustee of the Faiths Forum for London.
Good morning. 55 years ago, Philip Larkin published one of his most famous poems. It's sadly not Radio 4 friendly this time in the morning, but it was about families and how they can sometimes cause more harm than good. That verse may have been in the minds of many people this week, with reports of yet another famous family having a public falling out. For Sikhs, the life of a householder and having a family life is a fundamental part of living one's faith. It's about being active within society instead of turning away from it, becoming a hermit or a loner. But that doesn't mean that it's an easy life, particularly when it comes down to managing relationships with loved ones. Almost all of the Sikh gurus were related to each other either through marriage or birth, with the guruship usually passing down from one generation to the next. By being part of the guru's direct family, potential successors would learn about the Sikh faith from a very young age, and understand how best to balance the complex social, political, and spiritual needs of the community. But there was never a guarantee that the oldest son would become the next guru. In 1660, the Mughal emperor Aurangzeb summoned the seventh Sikh guru to explain why he had supported a rival in the war for succession to the Mughal throne. The guru sent his oldest son, Ram Rai, to represent him, and during their meeting, Ram Rai changed a line within the Sikh scriptures to appease the emperor. When the guru discovered this, he excommunicated Ram Rai for lacking the moral strength and conviction to remain true to the faith. If he couldn't stand up to the emperor over a single line of scripture, how could he lead and care for the Sikh community in the difficult times to come? The seventh guru instead named his four-year-old son as the next guru. Ram Rai led a religious sect for many years, but as time went on, he felt isolated and alone. It's said that he met with the 10th guru to seek his forgiveness and be reconciled with his family once again, and by agreement, Ram Rai did not name a successor to his sect when he died. The family was reunited. Guru Nanak said, "Make compassion the cotton, contentment the thread, modesty the knot and truth the twist. This is the sacred thread of the soul." Family breakdowns are more common than we want to admit. As a family law barrister, I sadly see such fallouts far too often, with the anger, blame, and acrimony that comes with it. But it doesn't need to be wholly destructive. With forgiveness, honesty, and compassion from all sides, it is possible for families to move on and open a new chapter in their lives.
That was Thought for the Day with Jasveer Singh. The time now is 8:08.
Were young people missold their student loans? That's the question people who took out what's called Plan 2 student loans are now asking, with increasing volume. If you don't know, a Plan 2 loan automatically applies to those loans taken out for undergraduate courses and PGCSEs, which started after fees went up in 2012 and were issued in England and Wales until 2023. This group of students includes some MPs, some of whom are repaying Plan 2 student loans themselves and are also starting to raise the issue in Parliament. Young graduates are angry as what they see as unpayable interest rates, which I should say, which they don't feel they were warned about, and that a loan has effectively become a graduate tax for 30 years. Are they right? What can the government do about it? George Holmes, let's start with you. Welcome to the programme. A 27-year-old Sheffield economics graduate now working at a large aerospace company in Bristol. In just a moment, I'll cross to the Labour MP for Milton Keynes North, Chris Curtis, who's currently repaying a Plan 2 student loan himself. But George, let me start with you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Is it a situation for you, for those that you know, where winning a promotion is not actually desirable at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm just earning slightly over the £50,000 threshold and my marginal tax rate is 51%. So that's 40% income tax, 2% Class 2 national insurance and 9% student loan. So roughly twice the minimum wage, but I'm keeping less than 50p of every extra pound that I earn, which is highly disincentivising at the moment.
And what does that mean in terms of working, ambitions, next steps?
Yeah, it's really hard. So I'll be paying this 9% pretty much for the full 30 years now. I earn an okay salary, but I'm not even servicing my debt at the moment. So it's growing exponentially and you see that in the data. So it's really, really difficult. I'm kind of at a crossroads now where, you know, I'm trying to push and get promoted at work, but also I'm sort of not seeing much of the benefit of that, despite, you know, renting, you know, not being particularly wealthy.
Does that mean you'll change your hours or slightly think differently about how to work? Because we also, obviously, as a country, talk a lot about productivity.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you've got doctors working in the NHS turning down locum shifts because of these really high marginal tax rates on sort of relatively low salaries, which is really, really difficult. And it's obviously then bad for economic growth as well. So, yeah, I'm trying to reduce my hours ever so slightly to help out with this Rethink Repayment campaign that we've got going on at the moment.
So this is, we heard about this campaign earlier, sorry George to cut across, but what I wanted to understand was, do you feel that you didn't have this explained to you? And what do you want to
really
change?
Yeah, it's really hard. So when I applied for my university loan, you know, I wasn't old enough to vote. I didn't really model my lifetime earnings. So I didn't really think about it that deeply, to be honest. It was kind of encouraged to go to university from the state school I was at. But it was a completely different economic situation when I was applying. You know, we were still in the EU. COVID hadn't happened. The economic outlook for the UK was much less bleak than it is now. So, yeah, completely different environment back then as well. But the interest rates are really difficult, and you touched on that earlier. So it's RPI plus 3%, which is, you know, more than twice the base rate. It's quite a exploitative, exorbitant interest rate that we're paying as well, which means that it's very, very difficult to clear the debt down.
Let me bring in Chris Curtis, as I say, the Labour MP for Milton Keynes North. Chris, you're in this situation, is that right? I believe you're 31 and you're still in this payback situation.
Yes, good morning, Emma. Yes, I am. I was the first year to be paying the Plan 2 loans, and you know, after however many years it's been now, still I owe pretty much as much money as I started off with.
And is there anything we can, you know, can be done about this if people are listening and they're also affected or their children are?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult. Certainly when the original system was set up, it was always assumed that it would be much better than getting a loan from the private sector. I'd say that probably isn't always true now. So that's always one thing that's worth checking. It was always assumed that you're better off keeping your debt in your student loan than elsewhere. I wouldn't always assume that is the case anymore because of the high interest rates. But I think it is certainly something the government needs to look at, both in terms of this policy, whether we should be looking at capping the interest rates to ensure that they don't reach particularly high levels, particularly when there has been high eras of inflation. But also, I think more generally, with us as policymakers, whether it comes to student loans, building enough homes, the way we set up the tax system, too often we have been biased and focused too much on the economic interests of elder people and not enough on the economic interests of my George's generation. And I do think Parliament and politicians need to start to think about how we rebalance that.
Do you not think that's happening?
I hope it's starting to happen, yes. I mean, one of the biggest problems that I'm sure young people would mention is how difficult it is to get on the housing ladder. This government is determined to significantly increase the number of new homes built in order to build prices down. But I do think for too long we have ignored the economic interests of young people. And I hope this government, so I'm determined to ensure that this government starts that rebalance.
We'll see. We have seen a few roadblocks from initial policy positions, and I suppose the realities of those on the backbenches trying to drive things. So, as you say, that's your hope. But just when you hear what George is saying there around cutting hours, doctors not taking extra shifts, and you think about productivity and aspiration and ambition in this country, what can you say, Chris, as an MP to George? I mean, there's not many years between you, but in terms of that dent on and that impact on ambition?
Yeah, it's depressing to hear, to be honest, and you do hear it quite often from young people, and we do need to fight really hard to ensure that we can build an economy that feels like it's supporting young people again and, you know, driving them to be the best form of themselves, to be going out there and working hard and determined to be as successful as they can. And often the economy isn't doing that. And
we're going to have to leave it there. I'm so sorry. Chris Curtis, George Holmes, thank you.
Now for the weather with Simon King.
Well, thanks so much indeed. It's a rather wet start for the day across many parts of the UK. We've got some strong winds out there as well. And the rain could cause some problems today, some significant rainfall totals to bring the risk of some flooding. So across England and Wales, it's just likely to stay cloudy, damp, drizzly, with some heavy rain at times, particularly in southeast Wales through Devon and Somerset, where we could have the risk of some flooding here. But maximum temperatures across England and Wales getting up to around about 7 to 10 degrees. For Northern Ireland, here the rain is just going to turn heavier, more persistent and more widespread later this morning. And there again is a risk of some flooding with temperatures of 8 to 10 degrees. And for Scotland, very wet this morning, especially across eastern Scotland, where the rain's continued for the last 24 hours. It'll continue all day today. And we've got an amber warning from the Met Office in Grampian, Angus, Perth and Kinross, risk of some flooding here.
Thanks very much. You're listening to Today.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 22nd of January. The headlines. Denmark says it wants to engage in constructive dialogue over the potential Greenland deal, which has seen President Trump lift his threat of tariffs and the use of force to take the territory. Where does this leave global diplomacy? Well, the Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will be with us straight after the news. Several people, including children, are missing after a landslide at a campsite in New Zealand. Government borrowing dropped to a lower level than economists had forecast last month.
And keeping with the dizzying twists and turns in the roller coaster that is diplomacy in the era of the second part of President Trump's time as a president, the second term of it, I should say, will there be sighs of relief from politicians, or are they still watching with bated breath? Our political editor, Chris Mason, will be joining us at 8:30 to try to make sense of it all from that perspective. And
the South Bank exhibition, Britain's proof to a doubting world that she still leads in science and discovery, draws to its close.
I love the sound of that. 75 years after the Festival of Britain showcased art and culture across the country, a new travelling library celebrating the nation's poetry starts its journey. More just before 9 o'clock. But now, just as we reach 8 o'clock, the BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
President Trump has said that a possible deal covering the future of Greenland would achieve everything he wants and last forever, after rowing back on threats to seize the island by force or levy further tariffs on European allies who oppose his desire to own it. Mr. Trump announced he'd agreed what he called the framework of a future deal after talks at the World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos, but gave few details. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, is following developments.
Donald Trump began his visit to Davos by insisting that the US needed to acquire Greenland for reasons of national security, saying, "You need the ownership to defend it." Then a matter of hours later, he used a social media post to announce that he and the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte had agreed the framework of a deal over Greenland. If consummated, he wrote, it would be a great solution for the US and all NATO nations. As a result, he said he would not impose tariffs on European allies. It is hard to see how Donald Trump can claim this as a victory when it does not appear that he will achieve his stated aim of taking full control of Greenland. Details have yet to be fully worked out and will involve further negotiation. A NATO spokesperson said discussions would focus on ensuring Arctic security through the collective efforts of allies.
Sir Keir Starmer is expected to discuss Greenland when he hosts his Danish counterpart, Mette Frederiksen, at Chequers today. In a statement published this morning, she said Denmark hoped for constructive dialogue about strengthening security in the Arctic, but insisted she could not negotiate on sovereignty, and again warned that only Denmark and Greenland could make decisions on issues concerning themselves. Christian Friis Bach, who's chairman of Denmark's Foreign Affairs Committee, told us President Trump's demand of ownership on Greenland for security reasons was unnecessary.
There's an open door for increased American presence, military presence in the Arctic and in Greenland. And this has been open since 1951. The Americans just have to ask. They haven't asked for 20 years. Now we see an interest. Denmark is willing. Greenland is willing. And if it's done within a NATO framework, it's even better. And this seems, I hope, to be the outcome of yesterday's meeting. If this is the case, it is something Greenland and Denmark welcome.
President Trump has said he will meet the Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky in Davos later today. At the same time, the US envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner are due in Moscow for talks with President Putin. President Trump has said President Putin has agreed to join his Board of Peace initiative. Mr. Putin has not confirmed this. Earlier, he said the Russian Foreign Ministry was still studying the invitation. Mr. Trump is planning a signing ceremony for the board in Davos later this morning. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
The Board of Peace was originally unveiled by the White House as part of a mechanism for the future governance of Gaza. It now appears to have morphed into something more like a rival to the United Nations. Its proposed charter, which makes no reference to Gaza, says the board will be an international organization that promotes stability and secures peace in areas of conflict. Countries wanting to join as permanent members will be asked to cough up $1 billion in cash. Donald Trump will serve as inaugural chairman and designate his own successor. So far, only around 16 countries have agreed to join. Yesterday, 8 of them, including Turkey, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, issued a joint statement saying they endorsed the aim of consolidating a permanent ceasefire in Gaza and advancing the Palestinian right to statehood. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who adamantly opposes a Palestinian state, says he's also willing to join.
For more analysis of President Trump's visit to Davos, you can listen to Americast, wherever you get your podcasts. Several people, including children, are missing after a landslide at a campsite on the North Island of New Zealand. It happened at the popular tourist destination of Mount Maunganui after days of torrential rain. Our correspondent Katie Watson is following the story from Sydney.
One survivor said it was like being in a movie, a tourist town with a volcano and a huge landslide barreling towards some hot baths by a campsite, wiping out tents, caravans and a toilet block. It's peak summer in New Zealand, the last week of school holidays for many kids, and the campsite was busy. Authorities earlier said it was still a rescue situation, and another two people are missing after a landslide damaged a house in Welcome Bay, about half an hour's drive from the campsite. Much of the east coast of the North Island has been hit by bad weather in recent days. Some parts of the region saw as much rain in 12 hours as they would normally in a month, with New Zealand's Minister of Emergency Management, Mark Mitchell, comparing the damage to a war zone.
The House of Lords has voted in favour of banning under-16s from social media, passing a proposal brought forward by a Conservative peer. The government has indicated it will try to overturn the amendment in the Commons while it carries out its own consultation on a potential ban. Government borrowed £11.6 billion last month. That was more than a third less than it borrowed the previous December and less than economists had expected. Higher tax receipts more than outweighed an increase in public spending, as Ben King reports.
For the financial year so far, from April to December, government borrowing totalled £140.4 billion. That was very slightly lower than the figure for 2024, but still the third highest total recorded, not adjusting for inflation. Higher receipts for income tax and national insurance helped the government take in nearly £8 billion more last month than the year before. That more than outweighed an increase in public spending, partly caused by an increase in inflation-linked benefits. The government said it was cutting borrowing by more than any of the G7 group of major industrialised countries, with borrowing for the year set to be the lowest since the pandemic.
The energy firm OVO has agreed to pay almost £2.8 million in compensation after nearly 12,000 customers suffered lengthy delays in getting their warm home discount payment. The regulator Ofgem says the funds were transferred more than 19 months late as a result of an internal system error at OVO, leaving vulnerable customers without vital support during the coldest winter months. Families of patients who suffered or died after they caught infections in Scotland's largest hospital have said they were lied to, demeaned and smeared. An inquiry into patient safety at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital campus in Glasgow is hearing closing submissions this week. It was set up after the deaths of several children and adults. Our Scotland editor James Cook reports from Glasgow.
For years, NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde denied that water and ventilation failings were responsible for infections and deaths on the Glasgow Hospital campus, which opened in 2015. But in closing submissions to the Scottish Hospitals Inquiry, the Health Board issued a dramatic apology, admitting it was likely that some infections were caused by problems with the water system. In a statement issued by their lawyers this morning, the majority of the affected families accused the board of deceit and conniving cowardice, saying they had been lied to, disbelieved, demeaned and smeared. They demanded accountability for what they called despicable incompetence and claimed the hospital was still not safe. The NHS insists it is. The inquiry is expected to issue its report later this year. A criminal investigation into several deaths at the campus is also underway.
Teaching unions are calling for more guidance to help parents make sure their children are ready to start school. A survey of just over 1,000 primary school staff by the early years charity Kindred Squared suggests more than a quarter of those who joined reception classes across England and Wales last year weren't toilet trained. It also found around 30% of children didn't know how to use books correctly, instead, for example, trying to tap them like a phone or a tablet. The Olympic bronze medalist Alice Kinsella is hoping to make history by becoming the first British artistic gymnast to return to elite competition after having a baby. The 24-year-old's career plan is so rare that a team at the University of Kent is studying her progress. Our sports correspondent Jane Dougal reports.
10-time European medalist Alice Kinsella said she always wanted to be a mum while still competing in elite gymnastics. So she had to time her pregnancy between Olympic cycles. Alice also knew the challenges she would face after giving birth, as pelvic floor and core strength are both weakened and are vital in gymnastics. She didn't have a caesarean, improving her recovery time. And just 7 weeks after giving birth to her son Parker, Alice went back to training. Researchers at the University of Kent are tracking her progress and aim to publish a paper which it's hoped will provide guidance for other elite female athletes. Alice, who won Olympic bronze in the team event in 2020, says her plan is to be back fully by the end of the year, which coincides with the World Championships in Rotterdam.
Jane Dougal reporting.
Caroline, thank you. It's 8:10. In a minute or so, we're going to speak to the Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, who joins us from Davos. But before we get there, it has been a dizzying few days with events moving at pace, troops mobilised, stock market gyrations, and a slight sense that in the end, perhaps not much has changed. Or has it? So we're just going to walk through a bit of what happened and what didn't. Last night, President Trump was interviewed on CNBC just after he posted on Truth Social about getting a future framework for a Greenland deal. He didn't offer a lot of specifics, but he did say the Golden Dome and minerals rights would be involved and that the deal would last forever.
It's not specific enough to know at this point how long this lasts, whether it's
forever.
Forever.
It'll be forever.
For Greenland at this point.
Yeah. Forever.
That's staggering.
That's better than a 99.
This is what, 2 hours after.
It's better than the Obama deal with the famous Iran nuclear deal with a nine-year deal. No, this is forever. This is a long term.
Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, spoke to Fox News' special report with Brett Baier about the conversations with President Trump, but he also didn't give many details.
I think tonight was a good night, and we have a good agreement to really start working on these issues. And that means that we both agreed, when you look at NATO and what NATO collectively can do to make sure that the whole Arctic region is safe, including Greenland, to work on that part. It will be there's a lot of work to be done.
Remember, way back on Saturday, Trump said he would impose a 10% tariff on any and all goods sent to the United States of America from European allies until the US is allowed to purchase Greenland. He said the tariff would increase to 25% on the 1st of June. And he wrote to the Norwegian Prime Minister venting anger at not being given the Nobel Peace Prize despite stopping eight wars. That claim is false. Europe, so often derided by Trump as limp and etiolated, rallied, with Sir Keir Starmer among those who describe the tariffs as completely wrong. Emmanuel Macron, President of France, called it a shift to a world without rules. Canada's Mark Carney warned of a rupture in the world order. Meanwhile, the stock market fell sharply, suffering its worst day on Tuesday since October before rallying. And remember last April when Trump announced his so-called Liberation Day, it was the bond market getting a bit, as he called it, yippy, that prompted his partial retreat. He is sensitive to stock market gyrations. Beyond America, it's sometimes overlooked that 45% of American household wealth is now in stocks, a record high and much more than in Europe. Partly because of passive investing, more Americans have money in equities than ever. And as Trump, they would have felt yesterday's falls acutely too. In a long, at times rambling speech, Trump addressed delegates at the World Economic Forum in Davos.
We probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force, where we would be, frankly, unstoppable. But I won't do that. Okay, now everyone's saying, oh, good. That's probably the biggest statement I made, because people thought I would use force. I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force. All the United States is asking for is a place called Greenland.
Then, last night, the threat of tariffs was dropped and the framework of a deal was seemingly agreed.
It looks like we have pretty much a concept of a deal. It's a little bit complex, but we'll explain it down the line. But the Secretary General of NATO and I and some other people were talking, and it's the kind of a deal that I wanted to be able to make.
Final reminder before we get to the Foreign Secretary that a 1951 agreement amended in 2004 already gave de facto jurisdiction to the US to increase its military presence in Greenland. From what we know, there is nothing in this new framework that hasn't been available to the US for decades. But then maybe there's something that we don't know. Good time to turn to the Foreign Secretary, who joins us from Davos. Ms. Cooper, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
Thank you so much for joining us. What is in this deal? What was agreed last night? What can you tell us?
Well, we've obviously had a period of very determined diplomacy, and our approach, the UK approach, Keir Starmer's approach, has been to be unwavering in our principles, to be very robust and coordinated and calm with our allies in our diplomacy and our messages and discussions with the United States, and also for us to put forward practical proposals to work through NATO on our collective Arctic security in a way that respects sovereignty, those fundamental principles of sovereignty. I do hope this now means we are in a better place and can now focus on that collective, that shared threats that we face through the Arctic, particularly from Russia's Northern Fleet. And I think the process now is to go forward and develop that NATO framework for dealing collectively with those shared threats.
But can you just give us a sense of what was agreed? What's in this deal? What, for instance, has Trump said quite clearly that he's not going to use military power to annex part of a sovereign NATO ally? What was agreed? What did Trump agree to? What have we agreed to with him?
So what we have proposed is a work through NATO on a new Arctic sentry, which is similar to, we already have through NATO, a Baltic sentry and an Eastern sentry. Those are really combined operations programs that draw together NATO countries to work on a shared threat. So what we have proposed is to do an Arctic sentry through NATO as well. What my understanding is from the discussions that we've had with the NATO General Secretary, who has set out some of the points that he was talking about yesterday, is that this is now going to be a focus of work through NATO, with different Arctic countries coming together and supported by other NATO countries on how we do that shared security. But let's be clear, throughout any of this, we maintain those principles of the sovereignty for Greenland and the sovereignty for Greenland as part of the Kingdom of Denmark. So that is unchanged and unwavering.
And final point on the specifics of what seems to have been agreed thus far, though of course things can change. Has America been given greater access to the minerals under Greenland?
So I'm not aware of any discussions on that at all. And bear in mind, I think the other thing that I understand will now take place is to be able to get back to, or for Denmark and Greenland and the United States to be able to get back to some of the talks that Denmark proposed on working with the United States. You referred to the 1951 framework, for example, and to be able to make sure that they can have those discussions consistent with that fundamental principle of Greenland's sovereignty, about how collectively they work together on the sovereignty of Greenland. Because look, there is a broader Arctic issue. A lot of the Arctic security issues are about the sea lanes. It's about the fact that the Arctic is the gateway for the Russian Northern Fleet to be able to threaten the United Kingdom, to be able to threaten Europe, and to be able to threaten the United States and Canada as well. So the Arctic security is very much a transatlantic security issue. That's where we want to now focus the discussions, NATO allies working together on shared threats, particularly from Russia, and we should get back to focusing around Ukraine as well.
I know that you're a politician and a diplomat rather than a psychologist, but why do you think President Trump seemed to climb down yesterday? Was it the stock market? Was it Mark Rutte's charm? Was it people around him giving him some pretty straight advice?
I think there's been a very coordinated approach, really across allies, and that's been consistent. We have also been raising our concerns throughout the US administration, also throughout different parts of the US system as well, and so have other allies too. So we've had a very coordinated approach. There have been some choices in this. This is the approach that Keir Starmer takes, that deliberate, very principled, very firm on the principles, but also calm and determined on the diplomacy, and to do so in a coordinated way. It is different from some of the choices that other parties have made as part of this process. It was deeply disappointing, I think, that we had Nigel Farage and Reform starting to suggest that it might be a good thing for Greenland to be part of the United States, just in the middle of the work that we and other countries were doing in order to stand up for Greenland's sovereignty and to make sure that pressure was on the United States. I don't think that was in the United Kingdom's interest, but we will always stand up for the UK national interest.
Is America today a reliable friend?
Well, we have a deep and long friendship with the United States. So I've seen, for example, the continued security cooperation. We continue to share intelligence in the deepest of ways. We coordinate in many ways. I'm in touch with the United States Secretary of State around what's happening in Syria at the moment, where the UK and US have had shared interests in countering terrorism and extremism in Syria and in that part of the Middle East over very many years. So we have very long, close partnerships. We know that the NATO alliance has been a fundamental part of our security. We do have some areas of disagreement. We should be honest about that. That's what Keir Starmer has made clear. We will be honest when we have areas of disagreement, and we will be firm about those. But we also have so many areas of shared interest, shared agreement that go back really very many generations.
And how do you think European NATO needs to reconfigure itself in order to make itself less vulnerable to threats of bullying, intimidation from President Trump?
Well, I think we've seen a very coordinated and firm approach from across Europe in response to this particular issue we've been debating. There is a broader issue that Europe needs to do more for its own defence, and we have said that. That's why we are increasing our investment in defence. We're also increasing our coordination. We lead something called the Joint Expeditionary Force, which is about the European NATO allies, particularly the Nordic and Baltic NATO allies, and the way in which we also need to be able to respond that's linked to NATO, but is also about being able to do fast deterrence and response as part of, again, protecting the UK's national security as part of that alliance, because we know it's those partnerships that we build abroad that make us stronger at home.
And you say you've got plans to increase defence spending, but you're not actually going to get anywhere near the 5% of GDP, are you?
Well, we've already set out the biggest increase in defence spending since the Cold War. That is the right thing to do. And bear in mind, too, that this is about what you think of as the traditional defence spending. It includes things like the joint frigates, the contracts, defence contracts, for example, with Norway, which is about strengthening, actually that is about strengthening some of our Arctic security and maritime defences. It also actually includes some of the strengthening around security and intelligence sharing and dealing with hybrid threats. So we have to increase our defence cooperation more broadly. Sorry, Amal.
So just to say, I'm trying not to interrupt because there's about a 2 second delay on the line, which is the wonders of modern communication. Just on the defence spending, it's worth saying UK defence spending was the third highest in NATO before the invasion of Ukraine as a share of GDP. It's now the 12th highest. So yes, it's going up in absolute terms, but others are raising their money increasingly. And some people would say, Ms. Cooper, that one of the reasons you don't have quite as much money as you'd like is because over many years this country is going to spend about £34 billion on this Chagos Island deal. And your old chums in the Treasury could think of a few things to do with £34 billion, I'm sure. Why is it that in an ever more dangerous world, this country's paying £34 billion, albeit over many years, to lease back, i.e. forfeit control, of a strategically precious military asset while permanently exiling Chagossians from their home and strengthening China's presence in that region?
Yeah, I think you're swallowing some of the propaganda on that one.
Tell me about it.
That is not an accurate description of what's happening. So what we're doing is, this is actually about ensuring that we can have very strong defence and intelligence cooperation, particularly with the United States, and to make sure that there is a firm legal basis for doing so. And we've drawn up a deal that, in fact, the United States strongly welcomed last spring as a result of the work that we had done to make sure we've got that secure basis. The payments is much smaller than the figures that you have used, which again, as I'm afraid,
oh, tell me, no, tell me, that's really, really, no, I really want to get the that right. Is it 34 billion or not?
The actual. No, it's the actual. No, it's not. And the actual payments end up being, I think it's less than 0.2% or something of the defence budget, less than 2% of the defence. It's a very small proportion of the defence annual budget that actually will go on this, because what it is doing is maintaining a proper intelligence facility, a proper defence cooperation, and making sure that we've got the legal robust grounds to do so for the future, and to make sure that that is not jeopardised, which it would otherwise have been if we had not reached this legal agreement for the future. So what we're being is very responsible in the national interest and making sure that we can do so and support things. There's been, I mean, you know, what you saw in the last few days was the United States, the president attempting over the last 24-48 hours to suddenly make statements about Chagos as a way to put pressure on Keir Starmer over Greenland. That is what went on. And really sadly, shamefully, the Conservatives and Kemi Badenoch jumped on that bandwagon and suddenly started shouting about this as a way of putting pressure back on the UK on Greenland. I don't think that was appropriate, because actually what we have done at every step of the way, whether it's around Chagos, whether it's around those sorts of defence agreements, and whether it's around Greenland, is to act in the UK's national interest to make sure that we have the robust intelligence and defence agreements.
We're, as you know, religiously committed to accuracy on this programme. I said that this country was paying £34 billion over many years to lease back a strategically precious military asset, permanently exiling Chagossians and strengthening China's presence in that region. Which bit of those statements. Which bit of those is factually inaccurate? Please do enlighten us.
So the funding, the numbers, the figures that you have are wrong, and also that this is about a long-term agreement that otherwise we would have faced, we would have risked losing the agreement and losing the ability to operate legally on the Chagos Islands. So we faced legal challenges as a result of a series of different things that had happened that meant so, that
yeah,
we
but the
might
advice
not
you got was advisory rather than binding,
operation,
wasn't it?
And we needed to be able to do so. Well, it was very clear, and as you know, we ensure that we do not take risks with important defence cooperation and important strategic arrangements for our defence and intelligence arrangements for the future. It's really important we don't take risks with that, because this is about our national security. And that's why we have made sure that we've got this agreement in place, in order to make sure that our national security is robust for the future. I know that, you know, other people want to just sort of make claims and statements and tweets and headlines and all of those sorts of things. Our focus is on our long-term national security. And we are the reason that we are doing this is to ensure that our national security is protected. We would not be doing this if it wasn't about our national security. Why would we? There's a lot of other things we could be focusing on around the world. The only reason we are doing so is because of the very clear assessment that we have made about what is in our national interest.
Yvette Cooper, Foreign Secretary, thank you for joining us on a busy day in Davos.
Listening to that at 27 minutes past eight, Katja Adler, our BBC Europe correspondent. Well, we've got a sense there from the Foreign Secretary in a UK perspective. What's their feeling amongst Europe, amongst leaders in Europe, going back to what may or may not have been agreed over Greenland and with Donald Trump?
Hello, Emma. Sorry, the line cut.
Could you hear me? Hello.
I'm sorry, the line cut out there. Yes, I'm on my way to the EU summit in Brussels. I'm afraid the line cut out.
No, it's fine. I was just asking about. Well, I know you're on your way, and you'll get more of a sense. But what you can say so far, I'm hoping you can still hear me. If the line's just slightly gone quieter there, perhaps it's ill-fated, and we'll get back to Katja Adler shortly. Sorry about that. You see, these are the things. These are the things. You managed to get through to Davos, but I think Katja's actually in London, so we're doing really well on that, aren't we?
It's tricky. When you do get through to Davos, you often have a longer delay.
Delay and trains going past and all sorts. But Mike's reliably sat next to me, so I can cross to the sport.
There can't be a delay because he's literally there.
I'm here, yes. And we have recorded this interview, so no danger of this going down, thankfully. But let's talk cricket, shall we? Because it may only feel like 5 minutes ago that the Ashes finished in Australia, but the modern day international cricket schedule moves very quickly these days, and England are already in Sri Lanka, about to start a three-match ODI and T20 series. The Ashes were, of course, ultimately very disappointing for England. A 4-1 series loss to Australia led to an ongoing internal review from the ECB. But one of the few silver linings for England fans this winter was the performance of this man.
Webster bowls to Bethel. He's gone down the pitch, swatting it into the onside. He's got it away. There's the 100 for Jacob Bethel, the first-class 100 in his career, and it's come at a test match at the SCG against Australia. It's a brilliant innings from a very talented young man.
Yes, 22-year-old Jacob Bethel played the last two test matches of the Ashes series and impressed with the bat, culminating in a brilliant 154 at the SCG in the fifth and final test. Well, I've been speaking to him ahead of this first ODI with Sri Lanka, and started by asking him if sharing the best day of his international career so far at the same time as an England defeat was a bittersweet moment.
You know, it's not that hard, to be honest, to balance it. You know, the whole reason you want to do well is so that you win games. But we were obviously 3-0 down and still with the aim of leaving Australia 3-2. So in Melbourne, it was nice to get over the line and get a win. And that obviously felt, the 40 I got there probably felt a little bit sweeter in terms of a team perspective than the actual big score that I ended up getting. It's tough to manage both, but, you know, I was pretty happy with the way I played. But obviously, we would have liked to be on the right side of the result.
But regardless of how the match eventually unfolded for the team, when you look at your own personal career milestones, a first test century scored in the Ashes at the SCG has got to be a big moment for you.
Yeah, 100%. It was a great moment and a great day. I really enjoyed the kind of whole process about batting, to be honest. That was very enjoyable. But yeah, cricket's a game somewhat of individual milestones, which kind of help the teams you play for win. That was lovely to tick off. First Test match century. It felt lovely. And, you know, I had my family there to enjoy it with me, which was great.
Yeah, and we all saw what your performance in Sydney meant to your dad. He was in tears in the stands, wasn't he, when you brought up your century?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they travelled a long way to come over to Oz in the first place. And yeah, they sacrificed a lot to get me to where I am. So to have them watching there when I got over the line was pretty special.
So just to delve a little bit deeper into this, Jacob, as we say, the Ashes was a very good tour for you personally, but just trying to get into the dynamic of the changing room at a moment like that. On a personal level, you've achieved something you are really proud of, rightly so. But is it tricky to overly show that? Because the overriding narrative of that match and the series as a whole was one of disappointment and frustration. Was it difficult to walk that tightrope? Did you have to bite your tongue a little bit?
No, to be honest, you don't really get too high in cricket when you go well. You try and keep things pretty level. So I'm not going to go in the change rooms and go blaring in just because I scored a few runs. You know, it's not really something that I do anyway. So the guys were obviously disappointed with the result of that game and the series, but it's not really something that I think about too much in terms of keeping my emotions in check.
What do you say to those who say that your style of play and the patience and poise that you show when you get a big knock is the antidote to Bazball?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think the way I went about it was how I saw fitted the kind of conditions that I was playing. I was still trying to put pressure on the bowlers in the ways I could. And I think that's kind of the main thing we try to do as a team. You know, sometimes you don't always get it right, and obviously you get criticized for that, but you know, we've got a pretty clear way of how we want to go about it. And yeah, from the outside looking in, it probably looks like I played a bit differently, but it was still with the same basics trying to be applied.
I was reading a piece in the Times by the former England captain David Gower after your century at the SCG. He was full of praise for you personally, but in the same piece he says, quote, "The era of playing with the utter freedom of not worrying about getting out has passed." Is that true? Is there a new approach now to batting in this England side?
I don't think so. I think the kind of era of not caring of how you got out, I don't think was ever there, to be honest. I think trying to strip away fear doesn't mean that you'd create recklessness. And I don't think that was what any of us lads felt and were trying to do. I mean, not much like in terms of that will change. We'll still be looking to put pressure on the opposition, but it's just a double-edged sword. When it comes off, it looks great. But sometimes when you don't get it quite right, it sometimes is not the best.
The last time we spoke to you on this programme was just ahead of the Ireland T20 series last autumn, for which you were captain. Is that something you want to do more of? Do you want to become more of a leadership figure in this team?
Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed that Ireland series. Obviously, ended up only being a couple of games, but yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I've good mates with Brookie, so just kind of chat through his thinking and just learn off him. Obviously, Baz is one of the great captains, so any kind of information I can get is privileged. And yeah, I look to just kind of take that all in. And if the leadership role in the side in the future comes up, then hopefully I'll be prepared to do something along that.
And just a word on this Sri Lanka series, which starts today. Strong side that England have taken to Colombo. The likes of yourself, of course, Joe Root, Bryden Cass, Ben Duckett, Will Jacks, Zach Crawley, all of whom were recently involved in the Ashes. They're all out there for this series.
It's been quite nice to, you know, obviously there's continuity in the team with the Ashes and the Test guys in and around the white ball stuff. And it's exciting. You know, everyone looks quite fresh after the boys that have been away. Being home after Australia look fresh and ready to go, and the guys that have been around the world playing T20 cricket look ready to go as well. So, you know, we're just looking to hit the ground running, and yeah, like you said, we've got a great team and looking to put in some good performances.
Well, we wish you all the best for this series and indeed for the rest of what I'm sure will be another busy year with England. Jacob Bethel, many thanks for speaking to us on the programme.
Cheers, mate.
And that first One Day International with Sri Lanka gets underway in 25 minutes' time. Sri Lanka have just won the toss, chosen to bat, and you can follow it on the BBC Sport website.
Mike, great stuff. Thank you. And now a look ahead to this morning's In Our Time. Here's Misha Glennie. Morning, Misha.
Good morning. We'll be taking a deep dive into the Mariana Trench in the Pacific Ocean, which is 2 kilometres deeper than Everest is high. It's formed from one tectonic plate slipping under another, and the very depth and pressure in Mariana creates huge challenges for exploration. But scientists have found remarkable life forms in the darkness, as well as large amounts of human junk. That's the Mariana Trench with Alan Jameson, Heather Stewart and John Copley just after 9 o'clock on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. And now it's back to Emma in the Today studio.
And indeed, her co-presenter, Misha, great to hear from you. Let's have a quick look at the weather. It is today, northeastern Scotland will see heavy, persistent rain continue, particularly in the morning. Rain turning to snow on the hills later.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. It's 24 minutes to nine. And let's get a summary of the news because Caroline Nicholls is back.
President Trump has said that a possible deal aimed at ensuring security in the Arctic would, in his words, put everybody in a good position after he rode back on plans to take Greenland by force or impose tariffs on European allies. Denmark said it would continue discussions with the US provided there was respect for the country's territorial integrity. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, told us the focus now would be on combined operations through NATO to protect the Arctic. Ms. Cooper also defended the government's deal on the Chagos Islands, saying it was about ensuring the UK could have a proper intelligence facility and defence cooperation with the US. She said the payments involved were a very small proportion of the defence budget. Rescue teams in New Zealand are searching for several people, including children, who are missing after a landslide at a campsite on the North Island. Tons of mud engulfed a shower block and hit multiple caravans. Official figures show that UK government borrowing slowed to £11.6 billion last month as tax and national insurance receipts outweighed an increase in spending. That's below the £13 billion most economists had been forecasting.
Thanks very much, Caroline. Let's turn our attention to the UK response. We've just been hearing in terms of Greenland and the New World Order and where we seem to have got to. We were just hearing from the Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, of course. But Keir Starmer will be meeting the Danish Prime Minister today at Chequers. And that is the day just after Donald Trump backed down on his threat to impose tariffs on the UK and the other NATO allies who opposed his ambitions to annex Greenland. As we've been trying to get to grips with throughout the whole programme this morning, Chris Mason is our BBC, of course, political editor. Chris, good morning.
Morning.
A relief to Downing Street. Could we hear that with the Foreign Secretary or now still waiting for more and have to be in a sort of, you know, primed for what's next?
Relief, certainly. And then, yes, all of the above about what comes next. I think there's a quiet pride in Whitehall and within government that Britain made its contribution to the kind of welter of European diplomacy in the last few days. But then, yes, questions about what comes next in specific terms. We got a sense of that, didn't we, from the Foreign Secretary, this idea of a new Arctic century, as it's described. What does that mean for the UK? What does that mean in terms of troop deployment with the opportunity cost of where else those troops could be sent over what kind of time frame? So there's still plenty of that to be worked through, to use the President's colourful language. Lots in the deal yet to be consummated. But the bottom line is the immediate diplomatic threat, particularly around tariffs, has been removed. And then that climb down, because there was a very frank disagreement between Downing Street and Washington, that climb down from America as far as sovereignty and Greenland is concerned, which, if you like, was the British bottom line, Downing Street can chalk up as ending up on the right side of, in terms of the outcome, as well as what they saw as the right side of the principle of that argument from the start.
I suppose we don't know, though, do we? Which I was just picking up from our US editor, our North America editor, Sarah Smith, earlier, whether it was European positioning that has led to this, because it's quite difficult at this stage, isn't it?
Oh, completely. The degree to which this is opaque in terms of precisely what has motivated the president to reach this conclusion is there still to be teased out. And the central truth, speaking to diplomats and others around the discussions that have been going on, yes, NATO and European powers were seeking to find an off ramp, seeking to find a solution that would deal with the concerns that they acknowledge Washington is right to have around Arctic security, whilst trying to clearly remain on the same side of the argument as Denmark and Greenland as far as sovereignty is concerned. But precisely how that has been arrived at in a way that can satisfy President Trump and allow him to say to a domestic audience that he has won the argument, we are yet to see. And of course, the other point is, just because the president has said something in a social media post right now doesn't mean, as we have learnt in his first term and this second one, that there might not be a pivot in a very different direction at any given moment.
What are the differences between the political parties, the key political leaders, in terms of the approach on Greenland at the moment?
Within the UK?
Yes.
So I think what's interesting here, and you saw the Foreign Secretary try and tease it out, because I think there's a sense within government as well that they think, and you might say they would say this, wouldn't they? They think that they have handled this within the domestic arena pretty savvily. Mm. So all of the main parties in British politics were very sceptical about the whole idea of the loss of sovereignty for Denmark and Greenland, of Greenland to America. But within that, there was a subtle range of views. You had the Liberal Democrats arguing about being more robust towards the White House. You heard what Nigel Farage said yesterday, where he acknowledged the importance of the sovereignty question, but did think the Western alliance, if you like, would be safer if Greenland was in American hands. And then you had the Conservatives backing the government on Greenland, but being very critical, as they have long been, on the Chagos Islands. And I do wonder if one of the longer-term consequences of this whole row is reopening that whole question around the Chagos Islands. Is that something the Trump administration continue to tease away at? We saw them doing it again yesterday in Davos. Now, a deal has been done with Mauritius, a treaty has been signed, it has not yet been ratified. Could the strings of that still be pulled away at? Let's see. And then there's a bigger point, Emma, which I think is worth reflecting on in a domestic political sense around all of this. The last couple of days is yet another classic case study of the attention economy in politics when you have a guy like President Trump in the White House. So the attention economy is just much more competitive when you have a presidency with a governing strategy which feels like the arc of a rating-busting reality TV show. How can a prime minister talk about the cost of living when I'm asking questions about Venezuela? You know, how can you talk about early years education when he's being asked about Greenland? And that has domestic consequences for our national conversation, as well as the international and diplomatic picture.
Chris Mason, our political editor. Thank you.
Well, what is this Board of Peace, which is having a kind of signing ceremony today at Davos? It's President Trump's Board of Peace. It perhaps sets some diplomatic challenges and opportunities. And if so, to whom? None of America's major European allies have yet made a commitment to it. It's not yet clear, as President Trump has claimed, that Vladimir Putin has joined this board. It appears Tony Blair has. Let's speak in the first instance to Lise Doucette, our senior international correspondent. Lise, good morning. There is this signing ceremony of sorts happening at Davos. What's going on, and what do you think the significance of it could be, Lise?
I like your euphemism, Amal. Diplomatic challenges. It was an understatement.
Is it diplomacy all about euphemisms?
So this idea of a board of peace has been around since last September when President Trump first started coming up along with his aides, this idea of his peace plan for Gaza. But it is clear it is evolving, at least in President Trump's mind, to nothing less than his very own, very personalized rival to the United States, a body to bring peace wherever war erupts. He was asked by a journalist, are you trying to propose an alternative to the UN? And in his President Trump way, he said, might be. Look at the details. President Trump is the chair of this board. He's the chair for life. He can serve as long as he wants to, even when he's no longer the president. And if he ever steps down, he will choose the person who succeeds him. He is the final authority on all disputes. Now, like everything else that you've been discussing in this program, everyone keeps saying the details are not clear. And so, too, about the Board of Peace. It was leaked that if other countries would like to be permanent members, they should pay $1 billion. But the others could serve for 3 years, I understand. The U.S. ambassador to Israel this morning, Mike Huckabee, said, no, that's not true. You can give money to develop Gaza, but you don't have to pay $1 billion. So the White House said yesterday, and the number keeps changing, that 35 countries, their leaders, could be at the signing ceremony in Davos, which will take place in less than an hour's time. So who has joined? The only European country is Viktor Orban. A number of Muslim-majority countries, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, Jordan, Indonesia, Pakistan, Qatar, they said they will join. But they made it clear that for them, this is the Board of Peace for Gaza.
Right.
Only Slovenia's Prime Minister, Robert Golob, has said the quiet part out loud. He said no because, and I'll quote him, the body dangerously interferes with the broader international order. I think I'm going to quote what Prime Minister Mark Carney of Canada said yesterday in Davos, naming reality.
Okay, Lise Doucette, thank you very much indeed. Let's turn to Martin Griffiths, former Under-Secretary General of Humanitarian Affairs, Emergency Relief Coordinator for the UN, who obviously spent a huge amount of time thinking about and working on Gaza. Martin, good morning.
Good morning.
How seriously do you take this board?
Very seriously, sadly. And as the days go by, it doesn't seem to get any better. And Lise, of course, has described it, as usual, very well. First of all, can I first say, though, you know, we must all welcome the activism of Mr. Trump on wars. I mean, that is an energy which we have lacked in the past. It's a good thing. However, what this board does, as Lisa just reminded us, is place the power to essentially pretend to create peace around the world in the hands of what will eventually be an unelected person. It charges large amounts of money to be on the board. It's obviously a reflection of the failure of the Security Council of the UN and of the UN writ large. I'm from the UN, as you know, Amal, so I don't like that. But most importantly, there isn't a good record of ending wars in this administration in Washington, whatever he may say about his eight wars. Secondly, in Gaza alone, which will be the first outing of this new brave Board of Peace, I don't think it's going to work. It's good that they're going to phase two, but I'm not sure it's going to work. I don't think the Board of Peace is going to add a lot of value to that. It's unaccountable and it's unrepresentative. And we've learned from the UN over these last 80 years, lots and lots of failures and clunkiness, but we learned the value of inclusion, of being representative of the global community, not just the friends of Mr. Trump. And we've learned that only through neutrality, especially at the head of this, can we expect any progress. One of the problems of the Security Council in the recent years, I know directly, Amal, as you know, is that the head of the Security Council, the permanent members, are not neutral. And I don't see how this is going to improve that.
But don't you think, I hear what you say about, given where you've worked for many decades, it's striking what you say about the UN and its performance on this particular issue. Do you think the measure of success for this Board of Peace will be whether it makes a material impact for the people of Gaza in the coming months or not?
I do. I do exactly that, Amal. I think Gaza is the first outing. Gaza is the first test. I'm not sure it's going to work. I don't think Gaza is an easy one anyway. And I think the test of this grand new scheme, which is a grand new scheme, is going to be whether it moves to phase two properly in Gaza. The signs are not good.
Martin Griffiths, former Under-Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator for the UN. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's 12 minutes to nine.
Today in England alone, there are over 100,000 children in care, a record number, but there aren't enough foster carers to look after those children. In fact, as the number of kids in care goes up, the number of foster carers is going down. On this week's episode of our podcast, Radical with Amal Rajan, I spoke to the remarkable foster carer and author Louise Allen about the crisis in the system and the solutions necessary, radical and otherwise, to fix it. It comes as Labour are preparing to introduce a new strategy to boost fostering in England. After a traumatic childhood growing up in care, Louise now fosters children and is campaigning for a better system.
I think the working conditions for foster carers, there aren't any. It's that one corner where if they shine a light on the lack of protection for people doing prolifically and sometimes dangerous work for averaging £1.10 an hour, if they shine a light on it, then that will expose so many other issues. You're so unsupported. It's so tough. You're wondering why you're doing it. You and it's not the child. And I need to make this clear to everybody. It's not the children. We talk, you know, I talk about screens, I talk about this. They're not the problem, really, when you're a foster carer. What is the problem is a lack of support and a broken system.
Let's have your top priorities, things that Louise Allen, if you were the minister, would introduce today.
I would kind of stop trying to recruit foster carers for a little bit. I would put all my energy into retaining who you got, because the people who recruit foster carers are foster carers. So I would...
That's so interesting, yeah. They're your best advocates.
They're your best advocates. And if the system is broken, the message they would be giving to probably the right people who to become foster carers is that the system is broken, don't do it. You can't control that. So what you can control is ensuring that the message they give people is genuine and reflects a system that is working, or at this stage, transforming. Because people will buy in. Foster carers want to do, they want to feel the pride.
Focus on retention, not recruitment. That does sound pretty radical. What does that look like? It means improving life for foster carers at the moment. Let's have some ideas for how you would do that.
You create a national framework. You, within that national framework, you put in there...
Doesn't that exist?
Like for health and for education, where, you know, because what you've got now, you've got, what have you got, local authorities, and you've got each authority kind of doing it their way. Yeah, there's no central accountability. So you need to have a new vision of what that would look like, because everybody does it differently. And that's why it's a postcode lottery.
I think that the government would say that's exactly what's going to be coming out. Well, the vision, maybe it's not called a national framework, but the vision is going to come out in the coming weeks. What about other support for actual foster carers, support with domestic work, that kind of thing?
You try getting out that door or doing your work through the washing, the cleaning. And you do that, and then you also have to work, and you also have to, within that, as a foster carer, you have a chain of command, you have mandatory training, you have mandatory meetings.
So what would give you more time?
A cleaner. Every fostering provider should provide each household with a cleaner, to clean the toilets and the bathrooms, to bring back the dignity, to free up the load, and to make the foster carers feel valued and loved.
Well, that was the foster carer, Louise Allen. She's also a very distinguished author. It's worth saying there's a real sense of urgency in what she's talking about. The numbers around this care crisis and what's going on with foster care are very, very striking. That episode has just dropped. Search for Radical with Amol Rajan wherever you get your podcasts, but maybe particularly on BBC Sounds.
It's 8 minutes to 9. Cast your minds back, if you can, that far, or let me take you there, to the summer of 1951 in Britain, when this happened.
The South Bank Exhibition, Britain's proof to a doubting world that she still leads in science and discovery, draws to its close. In 5 months, 8.5 million people have found pleasure and instruction here. But now the curtain is due to fall. Along the crowded fairway come the massed bands of the Brigade of Guards.
It sounds great, doesn't it? An excerpt from the Pathé archive there, covering the Festival of Britain, the travelling exhibitions from which inspired a project at the South Bank this year called A Poet in Every Port. From May, a mobile version of the National Poetry Library, if you haven't been to it, it's a lovely place and a lovely experience, I should say, will travel to Penzance, Yarmouth and 9 other locations. Roger McGough, who's the president of the Poetry Society, a celebrated poet himself, and you might know him as the presenter of Poetry Please here on Radio 4, is going to be an ambassador for this project. He's just joined us now in the studio. I'll come to you in just a moment, Roger. But let me first turn to Chris McCabe, who's the head of the National Poetry Library, as we just mentioned, and is organising this lovely sounding project for the South Bank Centre. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's going to happen?
So we're taking the spirit of the National Poetry Library, all the wonderful things you can do in the National Poetry Library in discovering, reading, performing poetry, and we're taking that on a mobile library, and we're going to travel to these 11 coastal locations, and we're going to work with festivals and schools and art centres to really amplify the incredible communities and the incredible poetry activity that happens there.
And this was inspired by travelling exhibitions of the 1951 Festival of Britain. This is artworks we're taking to every area in Britain and and so forth.
That's right, yeah. So we're taking the spirit of 1951 and that kind of innovation, but we're very much looking to the future, and we're exploring how the South Bank Centre, which National Poetry Library is part of, can be the art centre for the future, and of course how culture and creativity can have great meaning in people's lives.
I say it's a lovely place as well, because I only discovered it by accident, actually, with the children's part next to it. And I then went in on my own later without my children and had a very nice time in there. Roger McGough, good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you for being here with us. And I should start by asking you about the Festival of Britain.
Yes, I remember going there. I remember I was about 14, I think, and came in on my first visit down to London. My parents brought me down, and we stayed with my uncle out in Eltham. And Festival of Britain's going on South Bank. It was just amazing. Everyone loving the time. I thought only Liverpudlians went crazy, like, enjoying themselves. But it was Londoners doing it.
You saw Southerners being able to have a good
time. Yes, I was really impressed. And the South Bank's been a place I've performed many times and been to, and the library is wonderful. It's central to very much to. It's my life, really, and so I'm delighted to be.
And I suppose those memories must have stayed with you and had quite an impression.
Indeed, yes, indeed. But not quite. I didn't know in what way it would be. It was just a nice place to be.
Yes.
But later on in my life, as I became a writer and those things, they get involved and you go back to it.
Well, it was also just that spirit of trying to take culture elsewhere and make a celebration of it as well.
Indeed, you know, because the thing is, it's a very private, I mean, writing poetry is, you know, a very private sort of thing, really, you know, and you never know who's interested and who's going to be interested in what you're doing, and is anyone else doing it, is it any good? Here, with the Mobile Library, going out to places, into people, you're going to meet fellow poets and share experiences. And it's all for, you know, optimism. You know, at times like this, we need, let's opt for optimism, is my sort of...
Yes, well, I imagine that might be also why you wanted to be involved and be an ambassador. But I think there's also that question when you take something around the UK, how a region affects the sound of a poem, the performance of a poem, and all of that side of
the
things.
The dialect. It's part of what we're doing in a way, yes. And one of my things, as I asked to do, was write a dialect poem. But it was a celebration of people. And it needn't be funny, it can be serious, you know, dialect. We tend to be light-hearted about, I think. My poem is light-hearted, but it doesn't need to be. It can be very serious and can be a eulogy. And it's just a celebration of the different dialects that we are lucky to have.
You're going to share what you've written with us?
You have to.
Go on. It would be lovely.
The poem is called Poetry, the Big Fish in the Pool of Life. The Pool of Life refers to Carl Jung, you know, the Swiss psychiatrist. And in 1927, he had a dream in which Liverpool was a pool of life. So here we go. Poetry, the big fish in the pool of life. And we should know, we invented the word, as well as keks, cobbons and the liver beard, and swahy, clobber, bevy and sliced bread. Fussy, of course, both blue and red. Scallywags, woollybacks, scran and whoppers, jiggers, blates, busies for coppers. I'm Nesh, and it's Baltic, chuckered it down. So ta-ra for now, I'll see yous round town. I enjoyed writing that. The words seem to flow. Dialects can be fun. Why not give it a go?
It's not often we get to say ta-ra on the Today programme. I might start signing off a bit like that, even though I'm a Mancunian, I can't quite claim.
Well, you're forgiven.
When you hear that as well, I suppose, Chris, it's going to speak as the head of the National Poetry Library. For those who aren't familiar with it, are you hoping you will be able to take more people into that world?
Absolutely. We're inviting everyone we meet on the road to write the poems in their dialect about their places. Roger's given us the first of its kind, but people can write whatever they like, thematically.
Serious poems, can't they? As I say, it doesn't have to be silly. Like
100%. You know, we have a great tradition of dialect poetry in English poetry, back to Chaucer, and we're thinking that the classics of the future could come from people we meet on the road and start to write with us.
Well, they'll have to start thinking perhaps now. Roger, are you going to travel round?
Yes, I'm not all the time, but I certainly want to. I don't know where I'm starting off at Great Yarmouth.
Yeah.